Our meeting will come to order unofficially. We do not have a quorum yet. So if everyone could take a seat and we could get organized. If you have Irish heritage, congratulations. Today is your special day. It's always fun to have an excuse to wear green. And I want to welcome all the families who have come today and parents and concerned citizens to learn more about our student data that we want to keep as private as possible. Today is a continuation of our fact-finding as we began some weeks ago into what happens to the data that is collected and used. So we're concerned about security, we're concerned about access, and of course we're concerned about management of any of that data. So we welcome you to this hearing. If need, it'll continue this evening in this room at 5 o'clock or about 20 minutes after session is adjourned. As I said, data security is an important issue. The bills that we hear, beginning with Representative Lucero's 2671, will be laid over or laid on the table so that we can continue to discuss these and act on them perhaps at a later time or perhaps after a study group has come together. Because this is such a complex issue, especially when we move into 2898, to which Representative Lucero has a delete-all, and it's good he's combining all these issues into one. So we'll begin by officially calling our meeting to order. This is so good. And approval of the minutes. Representative Ward, would you take a quick glance at the minutes to see if... you can move approval.
Oh, I'm sorry, I was distracted. Madam Chair, I move the minutes.
Representative Ward moves approval of the minutes from March 15. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes from March 15, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those who disapprove, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Welcome, Representative Lucero, to the testifying table. And he was so kind as to prepare a student private data PowerPoint, which is always welcomed in this committee, so that we have both visual and audio presentation.
Thank you, Madam
Representative
Chair.
Representative Lucero, I will move House File 2671 to be laid over for additional examination. Please proceed. Introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Representative Eric Lucero, and there are several bills, as you mentioned, related to student private data. And how I want to start here is to lay a foundation. So this is a very important topic. It is a very complex topic. And what I want to do is, in laying that foundation, just give some background. And what's the catalyst for why we're here today and why this is so important. So student private data, and there are two goals with these bills. It's to protect student private data, and it's to ensure parental authority over their children's private data. So by way of background, so we currently have a chapter in Minnesota statutes pertaining to education and technology. It's chapter 125B. But it is only 6 pages in length, and I actually brought it here. So chapter 125B, that's it, right there. 6 pages in length. It dates back to 1980. There are several sections in 125B. One section is contracts for computers and equipment in schools. That section hasn't been updated since 2000. MDE department duties. That section has not been updated since 2003. Internet access for students, the section has not been updated since 2007. But during that time, since the 1980s, the origin of the chapter, whether it be 2000, 2003, 2007, there's been monumental changes, we're well aware, in the innovation of technology. And that monumental innovation of technology has also created many new capabilities that our technology allows. As we're aware, there's many positive benefits to the new technology. The use of technology in the classroom better prepares our students to be more competitive in a global workforce, allows for increased efficiencies and decreased costs for our schools, and there's many other benefits. But there's a problem. So the flip side of that technology innovation coin is that the new technology capabilities have also caused alarm for many parents, and that alarm is big data. So big data causing the alarm. Big data is the mass collection of student data. Data storage and data warehousing is a concern. Data aggregation, and for those who can see the PowerPoint, you can see in the lower right-hand corner, data aggregation is taking multiple pieces of information, pulling them all together into one place. Data correlation, data mining. And data correlation, data mining is establishing patterns. It builds profiles on students or allows for the building of profiles on students. And to harvest intelligent, actionable information. In other words, big data equals the intersection of data and human behavior. Sharing of student private data with third parties is also a very large concern. In fact, just a few weeks back in this very committee, we had an informational hearing on student private data. One of the testifiers was the Minnesota Department of Education. And in that testimony, in regards to sharing student private data with third parties, they admitted that they have not audited any of the third parties by which they're sharing our students' private data with in at least a decade. So big data is big money. Mm-hmm. And you can see here by some of these graphics that big business understands this, because knowledge is power. And the knowledge of human behavior and profiles that can be created as a result of the collection of big data, again, translates to big money. And that's in part what's driving this. So I have a few examples here of data mining. So here, this is ripped from the headlines. So data mining, how companies know everything about you, every detail of your life, what you buy, where you go, whom you love, etc. Data mining and analytics, the volume and diversity of data being captured by companies today is staggering. How your data are being deeply mined, using techniques ranging from supermarket loyalty cards to targeted advertising on Facebook, private companies, etc. So data mining examples. One of my favorites is right here locally, Target. So some of you may have seen this headline. This is from back 2013. Just to summarize here, there was a father. A man walked into a Target outside Minneapolis demanding to see the manager. He was angry over coupons for baby clothes and cribs that had been sent to his daughter, who was still in high school. "How dare Target encourage teen pregnancy," he ranted. The manager apologized and then called a few days later to apologize again. On the phone, however, the father said he had a talk with his daughter, and it turned out she was pregnant, and the father apologized to the manager. Well, how did Target know this? Target knew this because of data analytics and behavior, and they're able to build profiles based on people's consumer habits, for example, and then other aspects that are happening in their life. So they were able to use that data analytics to target coupons. In the testimony here a few weeks back, we heard about MinLink. MinLink is a centralized database that, in part, this is a screenshot I took right off the University of Minnesota's website. You can see in the center there, it's the centralized database. On the bottom there, you can see that National Science Foundation is, in part, involved with this centralized database. And the databases around it are the source of the information that's being collected in the centralized database. And of those, you can see there are four of them that are being fed. Actually, it's three. It's three being fed by the Minnesota Department of Education. So you have academic disciplinary records, standardized test records, the MCAs, and general education testing records are three databases that are being fed in. And combined with information here from Department of Health, so you have child protection records, children's mental health records, you have a database, juvenile court records, records of incarcerated adults, and then Medicaid claims. Right, this is just one example that's happening today. So example of breaches of government technology systems, which is another cause for alarm. So there are two types of data breaches. Most of us are familiar with the first type, those gaining access who are not authorized, typically given the word hacking. So you gain access to a technology system that you don't have authorized to, you don't, are not authorized to access. But there's even a more important, that is very important, but there's also another very important type of data breach. That's the second type. Those abusing access who are authorized to view the data. So you have access, but now you're going above and beyond a business-justified use of access to that data. So here's ripped from the headlines. A few local government technology systems that were breached in the last few years. This one, 5,000 alerted of record breach in DNR by a DNR employee. That's from January of 2013. Here, a KMSP anchor lawsuit claims cops were snooping on her license. That's from February of 2014. So this is, again, people who had access to the data but were misusing it. This is from the Department of Public Safety. August of 2015, 18 driver's licenses were accessed. Unauthorized lookup by two individuals discovered. Here's a lawsuit. This is from February of 2013. New lawsuit over breach of data, driver's license data. This is 1,100 queries by an employee at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Here from April of 2015, Metro State, 160,000 student records. This one is Minsher. In-house flaws faulted in Minsher data breach. Audit finds, this one is from February of 2013, audit finds common misuse of Minnesota driver's data. By so the quote from legislative auditor Jim Nobles, we have a real problem. So what's the solution? So the intent of the bills that I will be offering here is to put controls in place to protect student private data, ensure parental authority over their children's private data. The intent of these bills is not to prevent schools from engaging in day-to-day operations, not to prevent teachers from teaching students, not to limit the use of technology in the classroom, not to prevent schools from having rosters or brochures printed for sports events, for example, not to prevent yearbooks from being printed and distributed, not to prevent photography services, the ordering of class rings, etc. That's not the intent of this bill, these bills. Regulatory compliance mandates. So the importance of establishing controls to protect private data on information systems in other industries has already been recognized. Being that I'm from this industry, I came up with a few examples. Sarbanes-Oxley. So years ago, the government already recognized the importance of protecting private data. So they created several regulatory mandates that are imposed on the private sector and are then required to adhere to those protections and implement them over their information systems. So Sarbanes-Oxley is one, Bramlage-Bliley Act, GLBA. That one pertains to financial institutions. Sarbanes-Oxley is any publicly traded U.S.-based company. HIPAA, high tech, that's for the healthcare industry. Payment card industry, data security standard, PCI. This one is not a government mandate, but this one is different than the rest. This one pertains to payment card industry, so credit cards, any vendors using credit cards, to secure credit card information, but it is industry grown. It was proactive by the industry to themselves create standards to protect systems, not a mandate from government. So in these bills, I'm seeking partners, all stakeholders, from everybody, because this is not a partisan issue. I'm looking for partners to help me so that we can create the strongest bills possible. The law protecting student private data and parental authority is way out of date, as I mentioned, not only in Minnesota, but also in states across the nation. This initiative, legislation related to this, is happening in multiple states. I fully recognize and acknowledge the language before us is not perfect, but the language is a starting point to begin the conversation, because this is a very complex issue, and we need to start somewhere. So here's the starting point for this language. This is a very complex issue because technology in the schools touches many areas, but the issue is extremely important and the time to act is now. As I mentioned, I'm seeking partners to help me tweak these bills to become the strongest possible to accomplish our intent of protecting student private data and ensuring parental authority. So with that, Madam Chair, I will start with Bill 2671.
And Representative Lucero, I think Representative Yarusso has a question at this point, or do you want to wait?
I'm looking at the DE, and so I'm not sure when.
That's later.
Yeah, okay, so let's, language comes up in the meantime, then I'll...
I've moved 2671 to be laying over, so please begin your presentation of House File 2671.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So 2671, there's really three areas to it. So Section 1B, it's consent required prior to sharing PII with third parties. So it requires requires opt-in consent from an adult student or the parent guardian of a minor child prior to disclosing PII to a third party or government entity over which the state of Minnesota, a school district, or the school has no direct control. Section 2 is consent required prior to administering surveys containing certain content questions. So it's modeled after PPRA, and I will have testifiers that will elaborate into that. It requires requires opt-in consent prior to surveys, assessments, etc., being administered, which contain questions pertaining to certain topics. And you can see those topics listed in lines 2.15 through 2.23. It requires a notification period of 15 to 30 days prior to administering the survey and allows parents the opportunity to view the survey. And then Section 3 requires opt-in consent prior to sharing PII contained in SLEDs with third parties. So we're familiar how PII is being uploaded to SLEDs now. This does not interfere with that. This is simply after the information PII has been uploaded to SLEDs, from then therefore subsequently sharing that PII in SLEDs with third parties. That's what the language deals with, is the third parties that might be shared with. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have several testifiers that I will welcome.
And Representative Lucero, do you have an order that you would prefer? We have parents and, you know, children and families here, so if it's amenable to you to have them come first.
I do have an order. I did speak with them in advance. If you want to come up.
Please, yes. Please come forward. We can probably handle a couple at the table at one time, but be in the queue. So, Pages, would you provide seating? At least, I think we could pull up a chair on either side. Representative Lucero's moving over, so very good. Yeah, I think the addition of one chair will work very well. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair, Education Committee. My name is Linda Bell. I'm a parent. I'm a former teacher. And I'm also, I work with a group called MAC, Minnesotans Against Common Core. We have approximately 5,000 members in the state.
Welcome back to our committee. You know, there's room for one more even to pull the chair out, excuse me, Ms. Bell, but we could pull this chair out too if someone else wanted to sit. Please proceed.
Thank you. Representative Lucero spoken about the intent of the data bills today, the delete all, as well as the HF 2671. And I would like to speak to the federal law PPRA. We are trying to make some updates to some statutes that haven't, you know, been updated in a little while, and so I just want to go over a little bit of this with you. The PPRA stands for the Protection of Pupil Rights Act, and this is a federal law. It is the inspection of instructional materials by parents and guardians, which very closely seems to sound like our parent review, curriculum review statute 120B.20. Mm-hmm. It limits on survey analysis and evaluations. This is in the section 2 of 2671. And all of these various things, it says no student shall be required as part of any applicable program to submit to a survey analysis or evaluation that reveals information concerning this long list that you see. And then it talks about the development of local policies concerning student privacy, parental access to information, and the administration of certain physical examinations to minors, more development and adoption of local policies. It talks about there must be consultation with parents, and they shall adopt their own policy, their own local policies, that there must be notification at the beginning of the year, most likely in the fall, and whenever policy is changed, that they must also, again, notify the parents of a policy change. There's the right of a parent of a student to inspect, upon the request of the parent, a survey created by any third party before the survey is administered or distributed by the school to a student. Let's see, the collection, disclosure, or use of personal information collected from students for the purpose of marketing or for selling that information, including arrangements to protect student privacy that are provided by the agency in the event of such collection, disclosure, or use, that is under the rights of the parent to see the surveys. The policies developed by a local education agency shall provide for reasonable notice. At a minimum, the agency shall provide such notice at least annually. I spoke to that. Offer the opportunity for the parent to see the surveys ahead of time. The local agency shall directly notify the parent of a student at least annually as to the specific or approximate dates. This is at the beginning of the year, during the school year, when these activities described are scheduled or expected to be scheduled. And then it goes into the exceptions, as Representative Lucero elucidated. This does not apply to many of the normal proceedings of the school year, such as college and other post-secondary education recruitment or military recruitment. It does not apply to book clubs, magazines, and programs providing access to low-cost literary products. It does not apply to curriculum and instruction materials, nor to testing and assessments. It does not apply to the sale by students of products or services to raise funds, so school fundraisers. It does not apply to student recognition programs. But there are remedies in the law. It does give notice that educational agencies and institutions shall give parents and students effective notice of their rights under this section. And if the schools are not notifying parents about PPRA, they are in violation of the law. The secretary shall take action to terminate federal assistance provided under this applicable program, and unless they find there is as they determine that there has been a failure to comply or compliance with such section cannot be secured by voluntary means. And so this is just a bit of a quick summary of PPRA. It's only a 6-page document, really 4 pages with some additional information. And I'd just like to quickly add, since I was explaining PPRA, in my own experience, I was here 2 weeks ago and I heard about a number of the data breaches on the West Metro side. And I also want to say that my family was also hit with a data breach. I didn't mention it last time. My husband's a school teacher at Hopkins High School, and several departments, staff, teaching staff, all had data breaches on the same day of the year. And so as many of you, if you have ever had hacked or had an attack on your personal identity, you know it takes 6 months to a year to try to recover and set up some sort of firewall or whatnot. And at this point, we are under the good hands of Legal Shield. But that's where you have to go. Actually, you have to go to LifeLock or Legal Shield to protect your personal family data, also our children's data, because all of it was, there's so much that is can easily be collected on staff. And so we are on Legal Shield for the rest of our lives. Probably my children will also have to have Legal Shield to protect their private information as well, because once that data gets out there, it just keeps getting sold and sold and sold. So thank you so much. I hope everyone here on the committee, Chair Erickson, will take these bills seriously. So many of us have been affected negatively by the data collection and data sharing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bell. Representative Russo, is your question relevant now?
Yes, thank
please,
you, Madam Chair.
Please ask it.
Representative Russo, I appreciate the intent of this. I have some concerns about the broad nature of the list on lines 2.12 through 2.14, basically. You've included assessment, analysis, evaluation, and we don't have definitions specific to this, your proposed legislation. We have some specific definitions of assessments elsewhere, as it applies to the kinds of standardized testing we do. However, when we don't have definitions, we have to rely on just common dictionary definitions and not the intent, what goes into law is what goes into law. So those three words, assessment, analysis, and evaluation, are very, very broad. And I'm concerned that this, if this were to be enacted the way it's written, it would interfere with specifically some mandated reporter functions in the school and attempts to help students. We heard a bill the other day about suicide prevention. This would interfere with a teacher or counselors or other persons in the school's attempt to assist a student. So let me give you a specific example. And I have permission to share this. The person in question is a young adult now and a friend of the family. And I shared a situation with my child the other day. So while my child was at the hospital, the friends got scared, and one of the friends went to a teacher and reported that she was also scared about a third person who was anorexic. And so that student was called in. So now, in that situation, you are asking the student questions that pertain to some of the things you've got on your list. And I don't think this is the intent of your bill at all to prevent this sort of thing. But in that process, the teacher and the counselor had to assess the situation, evaluate the situation, ask the student very personal questions. And in many situations, you don't know what the situation at home is until you ask some questions. So it's not always appropriate to call the parent as the first thing, because sometimes that's the source of the problem. If you have a student that's being abused at home, until you've done some evaluation of that and asked some of these very personal questions, you don't know that. And teachers and principals and counselors and school psychologists and everybody else in that school has a mandated reporter function. And that mandate is not to call the parent. It's to call to take whatever steps are necessary to protect that child. So what I would like to see happen with this is either to take those three words out, which I don't think you probably want to do, or maybe take some of them. I mean, analysis, actually, frankly, is a function of what you do to the data. It's not taking the data. So I think analysis could be lost without harming your intent at all. Maybe make definitions so that you don't unwittingly cause a future problem or something. Thank you.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Urso, thank you for that. And yes, that is not the intent. We do not want to interfere with saving lives. Not at all. We want to protect as many lives of our children as possible. And that's a great example of where we definitely want to make sure that we have language that creates the necessary exceptions. But I will just add one more thing, just to reiterate, that the language that's being referred to here is identical to the PPRA, which is already federal law. So these words are federal law. This is already a requirement. So the question is, do we need to look to the definition of those words as they are in federal law, or further refine those definitions? But exactly. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have certain other circumstances where federal law does not always reflect having talked to some teachers. Okay, so if you just, you know, work with some of us, I'm sure we can come up with a solution. Thank you.
Representative Akrisha, I think, has it to this point.
Just, yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And just a point of parliamentary inquiry. Are we actually on the testifiers, or are we actually on the bill language? I would recommend we get through the testifiers first. We can hear the entire context, and then we get into the specifics. But just an inquiry.
Thank you. And I did ask if the question was relevant, and agree that Representative Russo had a relevant question. Representative Whalen and Representative Bennett, can you wait until... Let's proceed with our testifiers. Thank you. And testifiers, try to tell us something different, because we, you know, we don't want to be redundant. We want to hear what is different or what is more concerning than what maybe Ms. Bell has presented. And members, you know, do note what the language says in Section 2 to which we were just addressing. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Robert Gerhart.
Please begin.
Madam Chair, representatives, thanks for having me. Good morning. My name is Robert Gerhart, and I come before you today to ask for your help in protecting our children's privacy as well as the rights of parents. I'll just give you just a little bit of background about myself and why I'm here. I'm a lifelong Minnesotan with a Bachelor of Science degree in Electrical Engineering and a Master's of Engineering Management. I spent the first half of my career writing software for automation, measurement, and data collection. I'm now a registered patent agent, and my job is to protect the secrets and intellectual property rights of some of the world's leading technology companies. I also currently serve as the vice chairman of Osseo Area School Board, the fifth largest school district in the state. It's my honor to share the responsibility over overseeing the education of approximately 20,000 students from a population of about 150,000 people. So in short, I have a fairly robust background in technology, data security, confidentiality, and education. I think we all understand that if you collect enough of an individual's information, you can effectively become that person in the digital world, and you can harm the actual person through identity theft or extortion. We've heard of things like ransomware. We've heard of people having photos stolen from the iCloud and being held and being used to blackmail people. Our schools have become a major collection point for our children's personal data. It can include some pretty sensitive stuff, and it's often shared beyond the school's ability to control or protect it. When a student's personal digital information has been breached, there is absolutely no way to undo the damage or protect them from the consequences. This is a new kind of problem that simply did not exist about 20 years ago. Today, schools are required to notify parents if they have a right to opt out of such data collection. One notification such as this is not that big of a deal, but in reality, schools are required to give parents dozens of such notifications for various topics. My own kid's student handbook has about 53 pages of such notifications and other fine print. Nobody actually reads it. I never read the whole thing until yesterday, and I'm on the school board. That should indicate to you how effective this is. I'm sure that the intent, Representative Russo, you were speaking to intent of laws. I'm sure the intent of all these notifications was to empower parents, but en masse and as a practical matter, it just doesn't work. So I offer a solution. I would like for us to look at the particularly sensitive topic of student data privacy as an opportunity to truly empower parents by requiring school districts to obtain explicit permission from parents before certain forms of student data can be collected and shared. We should move away from the implied consent of opting out and replace it with the express consent of opting in. Such a change would not put any additional burden on schools and may even decrease it slightly. because right now we process opt-outs. They're a very small number because, again, very few people realize they can even do it. I would say that the parents that would be really enthused about opting their students into such data collection will probably be even fewer. So, in summary, a parent has the ultimate responsibility and authority for their own child's education and well-being. The change I'm asking for simply returns some control over a particularly sensitive topic back to where it rightfully belongs. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gearhart. Ms. Schultz? Or please, who's ever closer to the microphone? Ann Taylor. And stay around, you know, in case there are questions later. Ms. Taylor, please say your name for the record and begin.
Ann Taylor, thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I have this book here. Some of you have this from last year. I don't know that everyone has it. And there was a blue bag with several of these in them. For those that don't have them on the committee, if those could be passed around or shared, there's about 7 or 8 of them. What I'm going to do is,
we'll just make them available.
What I wanted to do, though, my hope was that if some of you have these, and like I said, they are here, I wanted to briefly, quickly run through a collection of surveys that have taken place in our school district as well as other school districts, and just quickly run through some of the questions that were in them so that everyone here today gets a better or clearer understanding of what kinds of questions and obviously evidence there is. This was from last year, from last legislative session, and then there is a second one that can be as thick as this. I'll just run through some of the lists. In the booklet, it contains some examples of the Minnesota surveys that have taken place in Minnesota and just brief write-ups of what the companies are and how long they've been in service. The collection that's taking place on it without consent. A lot of this is considered passive consent. There are concerns with passive consent. One of the major criticisms of using passive consent procedures is that the parent or guardian may not get the information they need about a study. For example, information that is sent home through the children may never make it to home, may accidentally be discarded when it arrives with other information sent by the school. The researcher has no documentation that the parent or guardian has been exposed to the information. Even if they receive the information, there is no guarantee that they have read it and understood that they had to notify someone if they did not want their child to participate. Now, we've been discussing and speaking about the digital age and how digital technology has taken over in the classroom. I've got here some information on PPRA, which is to protect the students, that some of these surveys that have taken place even in our own district have violated PPRA by asking some very personal questions. PPRA is to protect political affiliations, mental health problems, sexual behavior and attitudes, illegal antisocial behavior, relationships, income, information about the parents, whatnot. Search Institute is one of them that's based here out of Minneapolis. They have grown throughout the United States. There have been several lawsuits against Search Institute for some of the questions that they're being asked of students without proper notification. The most recent one that got a lot of exposure, I believe, about a year ago was in the state of New Hampshire. And this was a survey that was going to be given to our school district. There's samples in here of the actual surveys starting in grades fourth grade all the way up through high school. And following this, some criticism from the parents, I received a notice from the school district, and I will read it to you because this to me is kind of concerning in that they didn't need to do the Search Institute survey because they claimed that they already had enough data in the school district to conduct whatever research they were doing. I don't know what data that was, but there's a disclosure in there, an actual email. ACT, there's a question in here, ACT Explore test. It's asking the parents' highest level of education. Now, that wasn't disclosed to me by the school nor ACT that this Explore test would be asking my child or any child what the parents' highest level of income or what the parents' highest level of education is.
Ms. Taylor, could you summarize some other points so we can move on? I think we've gotten the point.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll just quickly mention Matchematics is in here. There's a, you know, a lot of parents are coming to us and not getting their annual technology notice. We used to get them technology notices by paper. They're now poked online. You can't get to them. Parents don't know, like what was referenced here earlier, we don't know what to look for as parents, and parents are coming to us at MAC and saying, we need that information. What are our rights? And we're not being told, and according to the laws, we are supposed to be, they're supposed to be disclosing this to us. That's a violation. Why are we not being disclosed this information? There's several others in here that you can peruse through. Yearbook surveys asking who has the greatest road rage in the school. You know, that's, to me, identifying a person, and if that information is ever breached or harnessed or shared. Also, online surveys in here asking the kids what social media accounts they use. When is it the school's business to be asking the kids social media? All kinds of other samples in here. I've been to my school board. I've talked about this and discussed it at length. That information is in here as well. All I want to say is that the last 5 years of this, since the first initial breach in 2011 and again in 2014, after those breaches at the Minnetonka School District and encountering surveys, I mean, this is an entire packet just of my school district, and there's a second one, a whole packet again that I would be happy to provide, the surveys that are happening again in the school, not just my school, but other districts as well. It's violating student rights. It's violating their personal rights. It's been exhausting, sometimes to the point of tears in the last 5 years of dealing with this. Our group here, Minnesotans Against Common Core, including myself, we're not paid to do this. We are doing this on our own time to educate parents so that they know what to look for. We're utilizing our own time and resources because we are passionate about protecting our children's education. And I will share with you that because Minnetonka may be recognized as being very tech-savvy, I knew what to watch for and what to explain and show parents what to look for. This fall, many schools across the state began implementing more technology in the classroom, and we have been flooded with questions and concerns on the lack of parent notification and rights regarding the usage of technology in the classroom and the nature of testing and surveys administered to students on school time. So I ask the committee today, please, for the sake of our children, together let us pass these bills empowering parents while protecting our God-given rights.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Next.
And members, let's, not members, testifiers, remember to address the bill that's before us to the extent that you can, please. We want to hear your concerns, but I know we're getting the message very well. Thank you. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Kirsten Schultz. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. MAC and I appreciate the opportunity to be allowed to bring to light what is affecting all of our children and the dangers involved in not fully vetting and informing parents of the infiltration of third-party surveys as data collection tools in our school. Imagine if one day you were to come to your office at the Capitol, upon entering you were handed an iPad, you were required to sign in with your personally identifiable state-supplied login. Imagine then you were asked by an authority figure to fill out a Briggs-Myers personality test or dating survey that you could pay the state for results to find the love match. While not telling you who was giving the survey, many of you would be anxious to fill whether to fill this out, wonder who this information is being used by and where it would go, especially with your traceable login. Yet these requests are coming from an authority figure and are currently being asked of our children in school, as Ms. Taylor talked about. Parents, according to Minnesota law, are required under the Tennyson warning to be informed of this type of intrusive information being asked of their students, but some of the schools are ignoring it. This is especially troubling in the current age of knowledge and of data breaches and the damage it can bring to individuals. The Tennyson warning states the government must give individual notice when collecting private or confidential information from them. This is referred to as the Tennyson warning notice. Government may also call it a private notice or notice of collection of private confidential data or something similar. The purpose of this notice is to enable people to make informed decisions about whether to give information to themselves to the government. When a teacher or government official gives a student a third-party survey, that survey by association becomes bound by the Tennyson warning. Most parents are simply not aware of this violation of trust that is occurring in schools that they implicitly trust to send their children to. And with all the scares adults have had with major retailers, hotels, pharmacies, restaurants, it is imperative that we put the same fear and caution towards our children. Is it not our children's privacy and need to their personal private identities in this day of ever-involving technology paramount to protect? This violation of parental rights needs to be stopped and the essential right of privacy for children reinstated. This is why we are asking the bill, the survey bill and parent disclosure bill that MAC is helping to support is passed. Data is a hot topic for a very good reason, which should be and needs to be supported by elected officials. This has become a simple human right, a right that is being violated by not adapting to the changes in technology that have occurred.
Thank you. Very good. To the school board member, Mr. Gerhart, is the Tennyson warning noted in the handbook to which you referred?
Honestly?
Mr. Gerhart?
I can't give you an answer to that.
Will you check and let me know?
Okay.
Thank you very much. And would you allow the other testifier who's sitting to your left to come before the microphone? Because it's so hard to speak into the microphone when you're sitting off to the side. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and try to give us some new information that we haven't already heard. Because I know that these are powerful testifiers, and we're wanting to learn, is there anything else in addition to what we've already learned? Please say your name for the record.
My name is Vesta Kelly. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name again is Vesta Kelly. I represent Independent School District 192 in Farmington, Minnesota. I am a parent and a grandparent. I'm here to talk to you today about this bill protecting student data and parental rights. I have had many dealings with the issue of student data, including but not limited to demand of full HIPAA release of my children by a school nurse. One of my 8-year-old children being questioned about the nature of a doctor appointment, intrusive phone calls from a school nurse asking how a doctor's appointment went without my solicitation of such check-in, administrative demand for full mental health records for my children, and not just diagnoses for the purpose of 504 or IEP, administrative demand for prior authorization for doctor's appointments, administrative demand for written explanation from doctors as to the nature and outcome of doctor's appointments, my children being asked to fill out questionnaires or surveys that ask personal information not directly related to their educational needs and without my prior consent, being told by a teacher that one of my children's academic progress must be tracked online to gather data to be shared before IEP testing could begin. This teacher had no idea who all would be viewing the data tracked or for what additional purposes this data may be used. My children being given free access to unfiltered internet content, in and out of the classroom on school-issued iPads and storing information in the cloud. I am an awake and aware parent who comes before you today with a great deal of community support from my district. I am involved and engaged in every aspect of my children's lives, and I am concerned for their future and the futures of all of our children at this age of technological advancement and data sharing. Today, MinLink, Minnesota Linking Information for Kids, is gathering the protected, personally identifiable information about our children, according to the Minnesota Department of Education, and it can and is being shared with anyone. As this is an infrastructure of data integrated across some state agencies under FERPA, Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which I believe to be an unconstitutional act. The information being shared broadly and stored in the cloud contains such information as child protection records, DHS, SSIS, student academic records, MDE, MARSS, children's mental health records, DHS, SSIS, academic disciplinary records, MDE, DIRS, records of incarcerated adults, DOC, general education testing records, MDE, GED, standardized test records, MDE, MCA, Medicaid claims, DHS, MMIS, juvenile court records, SCAO, MNCIS, and so on. There are global education standards and data gathering in conjunction with Common Core State Standards Initiative with a cradle-to-grave tracking system via data sets on both students and teachers. Third-party companies are being paid by local districts to handle personally identifiable information about our children to satisfy federal mandates. And they are also being stored in the cloud. Meanwhile, school boards don't know where this information is going. All of this data storing and sharing puts each of our children at risk, as this information is accessible and hackable to anyone. This creates a very real risk of identity theft for our children. Not only that, but it makes our children easily accessible to predators, such as kidnappers, murderers, rapists, and there are no protections in place for our children by the NSBA, National School Board Association, per the 2014 White Paper Data Privacy Protections, or any other agencies. Such data collection and sharing creates a genetic passport for global education futures and other data sharing purposes, where, quote, participants co-own the agenda and the outcome, end quote, where data sets will be used to chart a career path for the students, taking away the students' right to choose freely. This is no different than slavery, giving ownership of our children and their personally identifiable, and their personally identifiable data over to private investors and the third-party elite. Our children are left openly unprotected, and these actions or practices of data collection and sharing are in direct violation of the 4th, 13th, and 14th Amendments of the United States Constitution and Bill of Rights. No bill, rule, directive, initiative, or action should circumvent or usurp the rights of the people or citizens. And under law, our children are both people and citizens. Their papers, property, private affairs, private information, and the like all belong to the parents until the child reaches the age of 18, at which time such rights are automatically turned over to the child. It is and always should be the right of the parents to choose what information about their children should be shared and with whom, including through the use of internet, schools, government agency, NGOs, third-party researchers and organizations, and the like. No part of our children's personal identifiable information or data should ever be used, sold, or shared for the purpose of tracking or human capital, creating data sets to be shared in an effort to set a student's trajectory in life or charter a career path predetermined based on data collection
or for any other reasons that would potentially violate their rights as citizens to life, liberty, property, or the pursuit of happiness. The sharing of such personally identifiable data of a child is to the right and discretion of the parents solely. We must stand up for the protection of our children's rights, the rights of the people. We have a duty as a free people to do so and to keep our rights and freedoms intact. We as Minnesotans must stand apart and set the stage, establishing a standard for the advocacy of our constitutional rights, the protection of our children and their personally identifiable data, not a standard for Common Core and data collection. We must stand firmly on the foundation from which this country was built. Our children and grandchildren are counting on it, yours and mine, regardless of race, age, socioeconomic status, illness, geographic location, or personal and educational capability. We have a responsibility to protect. We must stand united as Americans. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vesta. Very compelling. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Carrie Kelzer, and thank you, committee members. I'm a homeschooling parent in the Stillwater ISD 834, and I'm here today because I'm very concerned about data collection of students and their families. I'm concerned for all students, public, private, and homeschooled. But since I'm homeschooling, I want to share with you how this impacts homeschoolers and their families. When it comes to student directory information, homeschoolers are not able to opt out of any data sharing as is done in the public schools. Our information is available to anyone and everyone because of this inability to opt out. And as homeschoolers move into post-secondary education, take PSCO classes, standardized tests, and the like, all of this information is collected and readily available to share or to sell. So naturally, one must ask questions. Where is this data going once the district has it? Who decides where it goes? Who's using it and for what purposes? We do know that the Minnesota Department of Education has over 40 data sharing contracts, including the University of Minnesota. And according to the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, HSLDA, we also know that Minnesota is in the process of developing a P-20 database. What is a P-20 database? It is a longitudinal data systems that are state-level educational databases in the United States designed to capture, analyze, and use student data from preschool to high school, college, and the workforce. Essentially, it means our kids will be tracked cradle to grave. That is not infringing upon our privacy, it is trampling on it. HSLDA also tells us that the Department of Education has reshaped Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, so that any government or private entity that the department says is evaluating an education program has access to students' personally identifiable information. Notifying the student's parents is no longer required. It is interesting to note that the Electronic Privacy Information Center, an advocacy center focusing on civil liberty infringements, warned that this revision will expose troves of sensitive non-academic data. What are some of these examples of troves of data? These have been mentioned. I'll go quickly because it's important. Child protection records, student academic records, mental health records, records of incarcerated adults, general education testing records, standardized test records, Medicaid claims, juvenile court records. This information on family and children is loaded into 9 databases as the MinLink Integrated Data System and held at the University of Minnesota. Additionally, MDA has had no audit for over 10 years of its data systems or databases. This is downright frightening. As I stated at the start, the dangers of the data systems are not confined to public school students. The dangers are very real for homeschoolers, as FERPA does not currently protect homeschooling families in Minnesota. There are so many dangers we parents face down on behalf of our kids each and every day. Data collection should not be one of them. Please vote to pass these bills. Thank you for your time, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Ms. Weston, if you are present, would you come forward? Because I believe you have to leave. Is that correct? Margaret Weston, General Counsel, Osceola Area Schools.
Yes.
Oh, there you are. Please. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to testify before the committee. My name is Margaret Weston, and I am the general counsel for the Osseo Area Schools, which, as Director Gerhardt stated, is the fifth largest school district in Minnesota with 20,000 students. I have worked with the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act for over 30 years, not only as the general counsel for Osseo Area Schools, but also for Minneapolis Public Schools, and as an assistant county attorney in both Dakota and Washington counties. I have worked with FERPA for over 15 years, and I have been active on the Minnesota State Bar Association Data Practices Committee. So I'm here today only as a representative of the Osseo Area Schools. I reviewed the proposed legislation and discussed it with colleagues who represent other large school districts and the requirements of the law. In reviewing the proposal, we have identified sections that are contrary to FERPA and to the Minnesota Data Practices Act and requirements that add additional burdens to our teaching and administrative staffs. In addition, the sections concerning the potential violations of school policies and state or federal criminal laws are not consistent with current case law governing imposition of student discipline. Specifically the requirement that when a student is suspected of both a violation of school rules and illegal activity, that the student's actions must be dealt with in the criminal justice system, criminalizes behavior that might not otherwise require the criminal justice system to start what some people have referred to as the pipeline to prison for student behavior that could be corrected within the educational system. So the most obvious inconsistency is in the definitions used in this bill and the requirements concerning directory or public student data. These inconsistencies not only add confusion, but add to the burden of the unfunded mandate to train all staff on requirements of the law. In other words, training all staff to inconsistent standards for release of educational data takes away from training staff on other aspects of their jobs. For instance, the proposal uses the phrase imminent threat to life or safety, and FERPA uses the phrase health or safety emergency to describe situations when school officials may act without specific consent or other authority to share data. The use of two different definitions is confusing and adds complications to the training requirements for the teachers and other staff. The proposal also imposes requirements on entities that receive public directory data that do not exist in either FERPA or the Minnesota Data Practices Act. In fact, the requirements that any vendor who receives public information must agree not to sell or transfer the data to any other persons or entities, to use the data solely for the express purpose for which it was provided, and to destroy the data upon completion of the use for the express purpose for which it was provided, is directly contrary to explicit direction in both FERPA and the Data Practices Act. In other words, we can't follow this law and follow FERPA and the Data Practices Act at the same time. These laws prohibit the public entity from even asking why a third party is requesting public data. If it's public data, we're required to provide it without questions asked and without any control over subsequent use of public data. There are also inconsistencies that apply in more limited situations, such as the separate standards and requirements for notification of data breaches. There exists a requirement for actions that a governmental entity must take upon receiving information of a data breach that exists now in the Data Practices Act that's different from the requirements in this proposal. The definition of eligible student under the FERPA also includes a student who may be under 18 but is enrolled full-time in a post-secondary institution, so it's not an automatic age of 18, which is the assumption in the current draft. And also, federal law also says that a student who continues to be a dependent on this parent's income tax is entitled to information on the student, even if the student is over 18. So the proposal also limits access by school employees to those employees with written authorization, whereas both the Minnesota Data Practices Act and its regulations allow access within the entity to those employees whose job duties require access in order to do their jobs. So although I appreciate the intent of the law, there are certainly difficulties in the way the law is currently drafted that would prohibit the school district from being able to enact both the provisions of the law as currently drafted and the existing regulations that we must operate under.
Thank you, Ms. Weston. I think Representative Lucero has listened carefully. There's always a balancing act. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to be clear, I appreciate the testifier's comments and concerns. And to be clear, that I gather from the testimony she was referring to my DE amendment,
yes,
which we'll be discussing later, not
yes,
the bill that we're discussing.
But she has to leave, so
exactly,
I called on
exactly
her. Yes.
Just for clarity
thank
for the,
thank
the video.
You.
Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Becky Lanis. I'm here to represent my friend Jennifer Black Allen, who cannot be here today. I'm just going to read a letter that she would
thank
have read
you
to you today. I am a parent of children in the high school and elementary schools in the Waconia School District, and I am writing to you to tell you about my experience with surveys and data collection within our district. This year, our district has decided to participate in the SABRES, a screener of risk in the areas of social, academics, emotional, and behavioral risks. Parents were notified via an email on October 7th, 2015. I got the email 20 minutes after it was in my inbox. I immediately emailed both my elementary students' teachers and the principal, letting them know that I was opting my two children out of this screener for a couple of reasons. First, I knew nothing about what this screener was, why it was being done, who the information was going to, and what they would be doing with that information. And secondly, it was not on the district's test and assessment schedule that was emailed to me by the curriculum director the previous week. And even today, it is still not listed on the school district's website. By the end of the day, I had been informed that the screener was done on my first grader already without my notification. It was not yet done on my kindergartner. I needed somebody to please explain to me how an email notification the day of or after a screener, survey, or assessment is any kind of notification at all. It was only after I continued with my email correspondence with the principal that I discovered that this information is sent and stored at the University of Minnesota with the FAST program, PII, Personally Identifiable Information, on students K through 4 in Waconia. It is being stored at the U of M, and not one parent was notified of this. Not one parent other than myself, because I asked. While I understand schools wanting to use the data to help determine if help is needed per students, class, or school as a whole, parents need to be notified of where the information data the schools collect is going and for what purpose. Then parents, as their children's education advocate, must have a say in whether their children participate. Full disclosure is essential. Accountability of the district to disclose any and all surveys, assessments, and screeners must be disclosed in a timely manner for parents to decide whether this is in their child's best interest. My children are in school to learn, not to be surveyed, profiled, and overtested. I do not submit to the exploitation of my children or their personally identifiable information. Thank you for your time, Jennifer Black Allen.
Thank you very much. And I think we have one more testifier. Please come forward. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Victoria.
Repeat your name before you begin.
Victoria.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of committee, I'm Victoria, and I'm here representing myself as many other families. I support the bill because it protects parental rights and families' private lives. Unfortunately, it is becoming common for schools to obtain information through students and the type of information that otherwise parents would want to keep private. There is nothing wrong, I believe, with asking questions, but the questions must be related and appropriate. Yet, the questions should not deprive parental rights to keep in private what should be in private. I am concerned that we are becoming increasingly aware of the occurrences with schools breaking the privacy laws and the students in collecting the data and information through students. I am in contact with hundreds of families, and many of them have these concerns. For example, Ina, she's a single mom with four children in school. She was not only puzzled but also offended when her middle school age daughter has informed that she had been questioned by the group of with the group of other girls by some, quote, lady who does not work in a school, quote. She was asking very private questions about family's life, including questions about divorce and parental relationships, questions on their vacation and house chores, questions on their friendships and lifestyle, questions on their feelings and details about physiological development. Alana, with her first grader, still has questions for the school. With an overwhelming joy, Alana sent her daughter to the first grade. In a week, her daughter mentioned that for the entire week, she has been excused from the class to speak with a woman who asks questions. It is not surprising that due to her age, Emily did not know that these questions are not related to her schooling and that she had the right to not answer. For that same reason, Emily was not aware that what type of information she should not be disclosing. On top of that, Emily was not able to remember the most of the questions, but she remembered a few. For example, where does family go on vacation? Do mom and dad argue? If yes, how often? As Emily stated, all these questions were about family. Edward, in the seventh grade, knows that there is data collection going on, and he's making sure to let parents know what's been occurring. While taking a state test in one of the ASIO schools, one of his math tests included a question about his relationships with his parents. One of the questions asked, how does your mom react when you are not listening to her? The questions all these parents have are, who was asking these questions? What other questions did they ask and why? So I'm also here on behalf of my three children who are sitting here. And for these same reasons, we are a homeschooling family. That would be our privilege to return to the schools, to the school, should the circumstances change. These are just a few stories I know. Unfortunately, there are many more. Parents upset because they cannot control what their children are coming across with, and they feel lied to, betrayed, and insecure about schools and the programs. They do not want that. They want trust in relationships. They want to support schools. They want to keep communication ongoing, but they do not want to compromise their privacy. They want their rights to be respected. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak here. I want to thank Eric Lucero for supporting our family rights here and asking you to vote to pass the bills. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Tatour. And again, welcome to all the families who are in the audience and to all the children who've come to learn about how their data is sometimes used, abused, and it is a very important topic that we will pursue very definitely. I think, members, I'm sensing that we need a study group to really delve into this over the interim. Sorry, we're going to be campaigning, but this is really an issue we have to take a long and hard look at. And with Representative Lucero as an expert in this area, that's a good thing. We really thank you that you can delve into this like maybe many of us can't to the extent. Are there others in the audience who wish to testify for or against this House File 2671?
Excuse me, Madam Chair, I have a
Ms. Kelly?
Question, if I may.
Just 1 second.
I have a quick question, if I may.
Yes.
I would like to ask this committee to please post my paper to the link site and make it fully accessible for public review.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kelly, and we will do our best to do that. Education Minnesota and Higher Education are coming to the table. Please do so. And then, members, any questions you might have for the author of the bill before I lay it on the table? Welcome, and please say your name for the record.
Pauline Galar with Education Minnesota. We represent 70,000 educators at the public schools, and we appreciate Representative Lucero's work on this. I think we'd really be helpful for teachers to have better definitions of what similar instruments might be. I was a civics teacher for 6 years in Farmington, and I actually used some surveys to help draw out where the kids their own political views. So they'd take a survey for themselves so they can understand where they might fit on a political spectrum, for instance, when I was teaching civics. We would ask questions a lot on what do you think of certain current events. So imagine a conversation around presidential candidate Trump, position on Muslims coming into America or things like that. We would just like to know, are those considered surveys? Are those considered part of this kind of conversation here? So that's our only concern about what what might be we using in the classroom that helps guide instruction for us. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record to begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Meredith Fergus. I work for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I am the statewide longitudinal education data system coordinator for higher education. I want to thank you for letting me testify today. The Office of Higher Education appreciates the idea of maximizing privacy and security of student data as presented in the bill. But House File 2671, as drafted, does raise some concerns for us, especially as it impacts the ability of the statewide longitudinal education data system to evaluate the educational outcomes for our colleges and schools in the state of Minnesota. Specifically, lines 4.11 to 4.24, as written, would prevent the Office of Higher Education and SLEDS, as well as any high school or college in the state of Minnesota, from obtaining information about students enrolling in colleges outside of the state of Minnesota from the National Student Clearinghouse. This is a third-party contractor for which we obtain all of our out-of-state college enrollment information. Approximately 12,000 high school graduates leave the state each year for college, and that is the only source of information on those students once they leave our high schools. In addition, SLEDS would prevent us from partnering with our border states of North Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa, and South Dakota to understand the educational and employment outcomes of Minnesota high school graduates and Minnesota college graduates. In addition, it would also prevent us from evaluating other educational outcomes, such as enrollment and developmental education, for students who do enroll in colleges in North Dakota, Wisconsin, Iowa, or South Dakota. It would also prevent us from evaluating the effectiveness of our Minnesota financial aid programs, such as tuition reciprocity. So we have consistently heard that the information provided by the statewide data system is very highly valued to our local high schools and colleges within the state. And we hope to maintain the ability for SLEDS to provide that data back to our high schools and colleges. However, the National Student Clearinghouse is not under the direct control of the state of Minnesota, any high school, or any college within the state. We do share data as currently allowed under Federal Educational Rights and Privacy Act and the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, as well as all other applicable state and federal laws. And those data sharing provisions do include data sharing agreements, which severely restrict the use of that data. It severely restricts who may access that data and provides strong provisions on how that data is to be stored, and secured and transmitted between entities, specifically from the state of Minnesota to the NSC and back. So that is all the testimony I have for you today, but let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fergus. The Office of Higher Education owns the state's longitudinal data system, is that correct?
Madam Chair, we manage it. It's actually a multi-agency partnership between...
And would you name those agencies other than MDE?
Certainly. It's the Department of Employment and Economic Development. We evaluate employment outcomes of college graduates to ensure they're getting jobs.
Thank you. Welcome to our committee, Mr. Arnson. Please say your name for the record and begin.
My name is Roger Arnson. I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principals Association. I might say I also represent the Minnesota State High School League, which has a small portion of the data piece. And on 2671, a couple things just to mention to the committee here. Directory information is an old concept. If you see on the front end of this, it has been around a very, very long time. That comes out of the federal statute, and directory information has been classified as a type of information the disclosure of which would not constitute an invasion of privacy. Local school boards have the authority to designate what is directory information. It's a bad title because it makes it sound like you're printing a directory, but it's not that. It's a classification of data that then becomes public. And I think as Margaret Weston pointed out for you very well, when it is public, we have to disclose it. Currently, and this is consistent with federal law, parents can opt out of the directory information provisions in Minnesota law. What the statute here, the proposal in front of you does, flips that. It says, let's make that an opt-in process. That's a lot of work for us. If you want to make us do it, that's fine. One of the things about this bill, and let me say, I think Representative Lucero said, made a couple comments at the beginning saying, this is very complex and it's very important. Those are dead on right. Yes. This is really complex. It's intimidatingly complex. I'm a lawyer. I've practiced in this area for a long time. And you look at this, and you start to swim on this a little bit. But there is one part about this that as policymakers, you need to consider, and that's, what are the local impact costs of doing this? Now, and I'm sympathetic to the parents that talk about, we don't want our student information shared. That's a value, I think, that needs to be respected and adhered to. On the other hand, we do a lot of things with directory information. We print a football program. You know, it has the kid's name, it has their height and weight, those sorts of things. But these statutes allow us to do that. And if you look at the consent that we're asking for here, you know, consent's kind of an interesting phrase as we use it, and an informed consent, you know, what does that mean? And I don't think you want to get to the point of what you all have, you know, when you've upgraded your iTunes and you sign a consent form that's 27 pages long just by clicking a button. But that is kind of what happens in some of this stuff here, and I think we'd like to avoid that piece on it. I might say also, it's a problem for us if you look into discussions about, let's create new damage penalties. This says if you violate this provision on the directory information, that you would be subject to presumptive damages in district court. I think what the intent here is to say, we want you to comply with the statute, but when you add these types of provisions, we do get invitations to litigation. I mean, let's litigate about this data stuff. And I think you want to avoid that as you're stepping through this, and this appears in some other provisions in the statutes that you've seen here as well. But I think you want to be really careful about this, that we don't send an awful lot of people off to the district courts litigating what might be minor claims. I know, and I'm certain my colleagues in the school world can tell you now too, there's another side of this these days where when we get large data requests from folks, that we have to spend a lot of money for the lawyers, and of course Mr. Martin and I are all for spending the money on the lawyers. I want to put that in here for my group.
You get most of it, Roger.
That's, yeah, right. But you know, you really should consider that when you're making these policies. And I know you want us to stay on 2671, but I might know, just as an aside here, in one of the other bills, there's some language that says we should delete students' disciplinary information after a certain amount of time. And Madam Chair, I think I've even talked to you about that. I personally think that's a good idea. I mean, we've thought for a long time, if you did something bad in seventh grade, you should get a fresh start. There shouldn't be a bag of rocks that you carry around in your knapsack for the rest of your life. On the other hand, the statute says we need to do this immediately. There's a pretty good cost to hire the staff to go through, you know, and do all of this data review, because we have to disaggregate it. So as you're making the decisions on this long term, we really want you to keep those kind of considerations in mind, as, you know, how can we do this, and how can we protect the data for the students? I thought Margaret made an excellent point saying, what are the definitions? How do we line them up with the feds so all of this works? And again, I want to come back, last thing on the school principals, on the survey data that we talk about that we don't want to do in here. I excerpted that out and sent it to my principal leadership, and I think the answer was, generally, we don't survey those things, and we don't really see a need to. So as we step through this for things that are other than the student survey, I think we can talk about some of that to make sure that we're not collecting stuff that we don't need, and I think part of the problem on this has become that it's really easy to keep this electronic data. You know, in the old days, it was all written. As we said, our data destruction policy was when the janitor got tired of looking at the boxes. Mm-hmm. You know, but now we can keep this stuff eternally. And these are good ideas to limit the amount of it that we have and see when we can't get it expunged under appropriate circumstances. But a lot of policy considerations here, Madam Chair, as we go forward with these issues. And we appreciate that you are saying we're going to study this. I noticed in the legislative auditor topics, it's one of the 11 that you're going to consider next week. That would be a good spot to get an additional look at this as well, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Welcome, Ms. Gilbert-Doherty. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mary Gilbert from the St. Paul Public Schools, and we have had a chance to visit with Representative Lucero about this bill and some of the other bills that are up, and I cannot come back this evening, and I have folks here that can't either, so I just want to touch on several of the issues that seem to be themes in all of the amendment in the bill this morning. As Mr. Aronson said, and Ms. Weston, Minnesota has adopted FERPA as part of our Minnesota Practices Act. So if there is a breach of data, parents already have a remedy to deal with a breach in statute. In addition, we also comply with COPA, the Child Online Protection Act, as well as the Children's Internet Protection Act. Last year, this committee overwhelmingly supported a change to the Minnesota Data Practices Act that actually updated the federal reference, which allowed districts to share limited data with notice to parents. For example, if you share, prior to that update, if we shared address information, we had to share it with everybody. Under the federal update, we can now just decide to share address information, for example, with the St. Paul Public Library, which is why we sought the change. The provisions in this bill and in the Delete Everything Amendment would actually reverse that action that we took last year and require us, rather than having parents opt out of sharing that for the purposes of the library, would now us to get opt-in on every from every student to do that. In addition to that, districts right now have contracts with vendors and get grants to provide services for the district and for students, and that is all permitted under current federal law. The opt-in provisions here and in the other bill would make it very difficult for us to fulfill these agreements and will often affect our ability to serve students. Right now, we share information with the Department of Education, with DHS and other agencies and other third parties. Sometimes it's for an investigation of maltreatment. Others, it's to provide health-related services for students. It could be that we're doing vision screening or providing dental screening or other services. We can't possibly anticipate what student might be getting services or might be having shared data, which is required in the amendment, and have a discrete student opt-in provision that would identify when, where, why, what the education purpose is for every possible opportunity that they may have throughout the school year for sharing data. And I don't know how we could possibly do that in advance either. Because in the provisions, as Ms. Weston noted, it does define a separate of how to share student data. And so we couldn't even share the name in many cases without the opt-in provision. The Delete Everything Amendment, in addition to the opt-in that's created by 2671, creates two other opt-in provisions. One that would allow us just to share data with any government agency or any third-party vendor that we don't have any direct control over, but also another opt-in for the one-in-one devices. And as you can imagine, that too would be very difficult. The opt-in for the one-on-one device would require that we include every single teacher that might have access to the iPad, for example. Well, if you have six different teachers, you might have a prep time teacher, you might be working with a counselor or a nurse or somebody else, or a substitute teacher. We couldn't, again, anticipate in advance who all the licensed staff that are at a building would be required to be included in that consent. We're also confused about some of the definitions that are included. For example, and again, I apologize for getting ahead of you, related to the definition of a one-on-one program, it says that the program would be available for kids who take the program at home, yet the rest of the amendment deals with provisions that apply to activities for students using the iPad during the day. In addition, the language includes the definition of a CI, student information system. For us, that's our campus system, and that's the system that controls all of our student data that we have to report to the Department of Education. So that would include grades, attendance, all the information that we're required to give through the MARS system there. And that, in our case, is not a cloud-based services. But the definition also includes other applications that educators, including applications that may have student information in real time. Well, if you know your students often, or students or your children might sign into Khan Academy or Quizlet or some other education apps, they normally sign in with their name or their Apple ID. So that brings a whole host of other applications into the provisions of this bill. Also in the amendment, parents aren't allowed access to the student data without written permission. We do currently allow parents access to the campus mobile app so they can view their own students' attendance, grades, upcoming assignments. This would not be permitted under the Delete Everything Amendment. The language also appears to give students the right to select what data his or her parents access. which is inconsistent with FERPA and limits a parent's right to access the data. There are provisions in the bill related to school employees and retention of records that wouldn't be work. For example, teachers under the amendment would have to have written notice to access the records or get specific authorization. There are timelines related, as Mr. Aronson pointed out, on the deletion of data. Some are 45, some are 60, some are 90, some are 180. We provided you with a copy of our handbook that we provide families where it clearly spells out what a student's right and responsibility is related to the iPad. Students are not required to opt in to use our iPad. I just want to make it very clear. However, we do not guarantee that the student has the same access to the device. In the bill, though, it says that if a parent refuses to opt in, we might not be able to take any action related to the device. So we're confused about that. You can see that we provide information regarding apps, privacy, passwords, and the like. But we also make it clear that the iPad is our product and that we own it and that it's a privilege to have and that we can have access to it at any time. I think Ms. Weston discussed the problems related to searching the iPad or being able to have 48 hours to provide notice or to possibly erase some cloud-based services. If there was a student who had taken an inappropriate photo, you know, or was using their iPad for bullying or some other thing, it's unclear under this provision where we could have access to the iPad and that the student could then delete that information prior to the investigation. And so we do think it has some safety issues as well.
Ms. Gilbert, could you...
Yeah, I'm going to wrap it up right now.
Because we need to recess.
Right. Yes. Overall, we just think these bills would make it very difficult for us with 40,000 students go through all of this administrative burden, and it would result in students not having access to services and technology. I think it would have a great chilling effect.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, my name is Peter Martin. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota School Boards Association, and I thank you for the opportunity to briefly comment on this bill. I expect to be back later, Madam Chair, so I'm only going to focus my very brief comments on this bill, 2671. PPRA, as a federal statute, has been around for a while, and I just wanted people to know that schools are aware of the law. There is a model MSBA policy on this particular subject that has been around for many years that follows the statute that gives parents rights to notice and an opportunity to see material. So this is not the first time in Minnesota that this is being addressed. This particular bill is a bit broader in language and deviates from the federal statute, which is a concern to us. For example, some of the information that would be included as part of an assessment or evaluation could be considered you can draw data from some of the prohibited areas, for example, in a special education evaluation. Special ed evaluations are exempted under the federal statute. So we would look to have parallelism between the proposed bill and anything in federal law to the extent the state law is necessary. And I would also echo Mr. Aronson's comments about the litigation piece and the presumptive damages in the event of a mistake made by a school official. There are many tripwires in Minnesota law right now that can subject districts to litigation. It only seems to be increasing, and this is of a very great concern to us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Lucero, thank you for bringing this issue before us. Closing comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, this, as you just mentioned, this is definitely very important, as we've heard. There is a lot of concern out there by many different parents and organizations and school administrators, etc. In some of the comments, we did hear several references to definitions. As I've mentioned, we definitely need to ensure that our definitions are as clear as possible because we do not want to unintentionally wrap in different areas that are not in scope. And as it is with technology, I'm familiar with the burden sometimes of trying to define electronics, because they're continuously changing. So that can be elusive, but we certainly can get it done. We heard several examples, great examples of what should be excluded. And again, I look forward to working with those organizations and members of this committee to create exclusions for what we need to do. We heard provisions and contracts. You know, one thing that's important is we have each of these school districts contracting with third parties, but there's nothing uniform. So you have children in one school district and the data of the children in that school district being treated unequally with children in another school district. So that's part of why we're here, is to create a uniform standards for contracts when school districts are going to engage third parties sharing or storing information in the cloud, et cetera, et cetera. There was a mention of directory information. We're in this bill, 2671, we're not seeking to limit directory information. Directory information is defined in federal statutes, and we're not looking to limit that. So that's my comments regarding that. I'm flipping from an opt-out to an opt-in. That is exactly what we're trying to do, is to empower parents. Parents are the ones that are in control over their children's data. Damages left civil court. Well, there is no damages specified. We're leaving that to the discretion of the civil courts, if they are applicable. Pushback. So I, being in the technology industry and the security, information security industry myself, I mentioned several of the regulatory compliance mandates that were put on us. And just as it was then, there was pushback. Because yes, it is, and it did, require changes to processes, changes in way the way things have always been done, to doing them a new and better and more protected way. So I expect pushback, but that's the way it always is when going from something that's obsolete to new processes. Then regarding surveys, there was my last comment then. We heard an example, I think it was the school boards associate, or no, it was the principals.
Yes.
They mentioned that we're not collecting the types of content that are referenced in here. And that's not true, because there are surveys that are being administered. Google Docs makes it very easy to offer online surveys at the teacher level.
Yes.
And it happens all the time without the knowledge, potentially, of principals or higher. So, Madam Chair, thank you once again for granting this opportunity to hear 2671, and I look forward to continued cooperation.
And, committee, I am moving to lay 2671 on the table. Members, Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, very quickly, what is the committee's overall intent with all of these bills? Are we going to come back to move them forward? Are we intending to move something forward? Are we going to continue to dive into this?
We're going to continue to dive in tonight and lay on the table or lay over, except for the chair's bills. My parent directory, which I want parents to know, I had the revisor go through all the statutes in the education code only and try to pull those into one place where you all can go so you know what rights you have when you're dealing with our public education system in Minnesota. Well, so that's my parent directory, well, Representative Mariani, and then the data plan that we would like the department to put together. So I think I may lay that over for possible inclusion, but we're going to hear the department tonight, so they're going to be very good. Representative Dabney. You're just waving at me. Thank
I'm
you.
Waving at you.
You're trying to get points with the chair. Thank you. So, members, we're in recess until 5 o'clock or 20 minutes after the session adjourns. Thank you. In recess. Our meeting will come back to order. Thank you for joining us this evening. My goal is to be out of here in about an hour, so hopefully we can move this along. The chair will move her bill 2813 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. House file 2813 provides an easier access to parental rights laws that we've passed over the years. As a chair of a committee education policy, I receive many calls from parents wanting to know where they can find this particular statute and this particular statute. So I visited with the revisor and asked if it was possible, if he had time. He's a new revisor, our Kevin Burr. It's Bear, is that how he pronounces it? Bear. Kevin Bear. If he had the time to search out
most of the statutes. Not all of them are in here, but about 40 of them are. And he did so, and so I moved it into what I call a directory. Maybe that's gotten a bad name, I'm not sure, but it is a list of statutory provisions on parents' rights that appear in our education code and placed in such a way that, as you see in the title of the bill, a directory of cross-references to statutes. So we didn't take them away from where they originally were placed, but put them in a more amenable place for parental reviewal, or for anyone, in fact, who wants to review these. So with that, I don't know, is there anyone who wants to testify for or against or with concerns or in favor of whatever? Welcome to our testifying table. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Good evening, Madam Chair and members. Mary Ciccone, Parents United. I just want to thank the Chair for putting this particular piece of legislation forward. It's something that we've needed for years and years, and it's something that parents will use from now on. Thank you.
Thank you, and I hope that the department will also put reference to it on the website. They do have some good information on their website, I think they could be just a little bit friendlier. Is there anyone else? Hearing and seeing none. Members, any questions? The Chair renews her motion that House File 2813 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Then we'll move to the Chair's other bill, and I will move House File 2762 to be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Members, this is a direction to the Commissioner, and I don't know if the Department is here yet. I have visited with Mr. McHenry. He will be here to make some comments to develop a detailed data security plan that combines administrative, physical, and technical safeguards for overseeing personally identifiable information about our students, that which is sent to SLEDS, and other student data systems. It directs the Commissioner to use existing department resources for this purpose. It prohibits the Commissioner from implementing the plan until the plan is approved by law. And Mr. McHenry and I have had some discussions about whether or not I'll amend this last statement that I read before we place the bill in a possible omnibus bill. So with that said, the plan components really reflect what we've been looking at in the last few weeks when we had the informational hearing on the amount of data that about our students that is available. So our question when we had the information hearing was, you know, the security of it, the accessibility of it, you know, who has access to it, and finally, who's managing it. And I'm so glad to see Assistant Commissioner McHenry. You're going to be right up, Mr. McHenry, because I know that you want to make some comments about 2762. We're off to a running start because we would like to end this meeting in a timely way. Welcome to our committee, Assistant Commissioner, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members, Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Education. Appreciate the opportunity to be here again tonight. I'm sorry, I was just trying to get my file updated here. So we testified in front of the committee on how we handle student data, how we handle data sharing and data privacy. And what's listed in Senate File 2762, for the most part, we already are complying with what the language is asking us to do. Enterprise or administration-wise, wide through Minute, we have an enterprise security policy and standards that is being implemented across every single agency. Right now, Minute is going through how we are handling our data and how we're handling data privacy, and they're assessing our levels of compliance. This report or this plan went into effect January of this year with the expectation that we as an agency will be in 100% compliance by January 1st of 2017. So with that, as I've looked through the bill. For the most part, we comply, or we're working towards compliance in all of these areas if we're not already there. A couple issues I did want to point out in the bill. If you look at subdivision 2 plan costs, depending on what is required in audits or what you'd like us to do in terms of auditing either SLEDs or what we do for auditing in data retention or data sharing, the amount of work or staff work or contracting with a vendor for an audit, that could result in additional costs. Right now, as an agency, we manage each project that Minute does for the agency in order to comply with law. So this would be something additional that we, depending on the definition of audits, this would be a potential additional expense that we would not have a capacity to undertake. In subdivision 3, it indicates that we would not be able to proceed with this plan until we came back to the legislature and had it approved. We see
I already
that
addressed that, Assistant Commissioner, and said that you and I had talked about this, and so we'll be discussing it further.
Okay, and we just wanted to make sure that, you know, we wanted to continue the work that we're doing, and so we'd be happy to come up with new language, whether it's bringing this plan back to the legislature for review, but we want to make sure that we can continue doing our work around this data plan. Under 1.19 and 1.20, in terms of sanctions for employees, contractors, or grantees, I think this is an area we'd like to continue to work. We don't necessarily have, we want to make sure that we have the specific authority to actually impose sanctions. Mm-hmm. We would have to look at work with our HR department in terms of what contracts we have with employees and what's already embedded in their employee plan, and see how that would align. But then in terms of other sanctions, we want to make sure that if we needed to assert any sanctions, that we would have the authority to do that. And then, Madam Chair, if you haven't already mentioned, obviously, under the statewide longitudinal educational data system, obviously that's something that is housed in OHE,
yes.
But that's something that we'd continue to work through on the language. So overall, I think what I'm trying to convey to you all is this is something that we're already working on. We'll continue to work on this. There might be some areas where we may need some resources to fully comply, but we're more than happy to continue this work. And if this is language you specifically want to include in your bill, we'll work with you to make sure the language is in a form that we can comply with.
And Mr. McHenry, you and I will continue to visit about anything that we would consider either amending, deleting, or even sending to finance. So that we'll continue to talk, and I really appreciate your rushing over here to lend some information that I need to consider as the author. Are there questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify? Hearing none, seeing none, the chair renews her motion that House File 2762 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill, and that she will be continuing to visit with Assistant Commissioner McHenry. Thank you, Mr. McHenry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Now you can go and have dinner. And I call to the testifying table our final bill on the agenda tonight. Representative Lucero moves House File 2898 to be laid over, and you have an amendment. Will you move your amendment, please, Representative Lucero?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a DE amendment, and I do move the A16 amendment.
And members, he's going to walk through this since it's a delete all, so I'm going to ask you for approval of this so that we can proceed. All those in favor of the adoption of the delete all amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. The motion prevails, and the delete all amendment is in your possession. And Representative Lucero, we're looking for, you know, an overview now that you've combined all this. And I know your testifier is probably going to provide that with us. But since we're laying it over and we could possibly have a study group that's developed to dive deeply into this, we want more or less an overview and then let those who are assigned to the working group or the study or task force to really get down to the nitty-gritty. Please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what the DE amendment did is it took three House files, 2898, 2899, and 2900, and simply combined them into one. Removing duplicate language, such as the definitions, which I think was common among the three, et cetera. So now all three are in one. So by way of background, Madam Chair, this is the language before us is, for the most part, template language that one of the partners that also find data student privacy to be a very serious concern and one that needs to be addressed. It is template, the ACLU is the partner. They have a nationwide initiative that is working in each of the 50 states, is my understanding, to take this template language and begin to move this very serious concern in each of the 50 state legislatures. And so I'm acknowledging that this template language needs work because we need to obviously customize it and tailor it to fit our statutes. We don't want to have duplicate language in existing statutes. We don't want to override or conflict statutes, etc. So there's work that definitely needs to be done to align and to customize to our needs here in Minnesota. So with that said, I am going to turn it over to my testifier here who can give a broad overview of the three bills.
Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Benjamin Feist. I'm the Legislative Director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. I don't usually get to testify in front of this committee, so I'll also explain a little bit about the ACLU. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting civil liberties of all Minnesotans under the United States and Minnesota constitutions. We have about 15,000 supporters throughout Minnesota and promote our mission through litigation, public education, and lobbying efforts. First, say thank you very much for having this hearing today and delving into this complicated but very important issue. As Representative Lucero had brought up, this is a piece of a larger data privacy initiative that is going on nationally that has a very broad consensus and bipartisan support. Minnesota is one of 15 states, and the District of Columbia, I believe is the number right now, that have bills very similar to these introduced and making their way through. We understand that a process like this will likely take some time and effort, so again, thank you for your willingness to delve into this. So to keep things short here, I was prepared to go into the detail of the 17-page amendment, but I'm happy to get out of here early as well. So I'll just run through what's really the intent of these bills, to be very clear, because I think earlier this morning there might have been some confusion about what was going on with these bills, and you know, I heard some pieces of testimony slip in on the other bills that were aimed at this. So I just want to clear up a few things. These are really three complementary pieces of student data protection. We're talking here about student information systems, the information that's uploaded to remote third-party servers, information input into loan technological devices like iPads and laptops that are controlled by third parties, so-called one-to-one programs, and also information that's being stored on personal devices that students bring to school, and how we're going to address that going forward. So really, despite the sensitivity of this information, the limitations on access to and use of this information by third parties and school officials has been frequently weak or non-existent. As we brought up before, there's very little in Minnesota's education statutes that really address this at all, and we believe that a statewide approach makes a lot of sense here. This ultimately means that private corporations and law enforcement often have easy access to detailed information about our children without their parents ever knowing about it. Together, this bill now retains the benefits of these important technologies to advance our school's educational goals while empowering parents and students to reasonably restrict who has access to their personal information. Turning quickly to the idea of student information services, the information that used to be stored in a filing cabinet in the principal's office is now being uploaded onto remote third-party servers, sometimes even in real time. Despite the sensitivity of the information, which includes students' grades, social security numbers, disability status, and information on whether they have been disciplined, received remedial help, or qualify for free lunch, few limitations exist on how third parties can get access and use of the data stored, and those rules that do exist are far too easy to circumvent. And to be clear here, we really are talking about use and access by the third parties themselves. It is not our intent in this bill to restrict school from using this information for the purposes that they would have it. We're really just trying to acknowledge the fact that nowadays everything is up on the cloud, and we don't have a clear sense of the responsibilities of the people holding that data and where that information is going. So the response here is really just trying to keep all of this information, again, a statewide level, consistent and as protective as we can be while still having the educational benefits. This bill prevents student information system providers from accessing and sharing personal student data on their systems unless doing so is for a specific educational purpose that benefits the student, the school, or the educational system, or where they have sought and received limited and specific permission from the student and or the student's parents, depending on the student's age. Children's data is a highly valuable and easily monetized resource, and we need to protect our kids from companies who are taking advantage of the relationships with educational institutions in order to get access to it. So that's really the thrust of the bill. You can see the details. There are plenty of exceptions that cover some of the issues that were being addressed earlier this morning, but there will be time to dig into that at a deeper level another time. I'll move on quickly to the one-to-one programs. An increasing number of schools today are participating in these one-to-one technology programs where a third party provides laptop or tablets for the school year. While these programs are highly beneficial, they also enable third-party device providers and school officials to track and monitor everything a student does with the device without the children's parents ever knowing about that. This includes what websites a child visits, what information they read online, what the contents of their emails say, and in extreme cases, even includes remote activation of the device's webcam. That's actually happened in at least other states and possibly more that we don't know of yet. The challenge with these one-to-one programs is that device providers frequently use devices to obtain personal information about students who use them and to build a commercial record on those students, whether the students want to be monitored or not. Students should not have to choose between having access to important educational technology and preserving their privacy. No one wants Minnesota schools to become a place where only students with the financial means to purchase their own laptop or tablet computer can afford to keep their privacy and get a top-notch 21st century education. This bill is designed to retain the benefits of these programs while empowering parents and students free of any coercion to reasonably restrict who has access to the device and the sensitive and personal information that may be on it. Device providers may still secure benefits from providing these devices, such as gaining early brand loyalty from students, as long as they do not infringe on student privacy. The final piece deals with student technology on campus. Students today are as likely to carry a personal technology device, such as a cell phone or tablet computer, as they are to carry a pen. When those devices are brought to school, even when doing so violates a school policy, the information on those devices should receive the same legal protections as they are afforded off-campus. Bringing a smartphone or other device onto campus should not trigger a suspension of all the legal protections the information on the device would receive elsewhere, even if carrying it on school grounds or using it during the school day is prohibited under school policy. If a student is suspected of engaging in a crime, warrant requirements must apply to searching the student's cell phone, just as they would off campus. Without these protections, it may become commonplace for the police to ask school officials to search students' phones as a way to avoid getting a warrant. Schools should be a place for kids to learn in safety, not face an increased chance of ending up in jail. When it comes to these devices, students should receive the same legal and constitutional protections in school as they receive outside. Schools are increasingly becoming pipelines to prisons, allowing a student's personal technology to be searched without legal protections just exacerbates that problem. While recognizing that schools need to be able to take reasonable steps to investigate and enforce violations of school policies on campus, this bill ensures that where a student is suspected of criminal activity, the student's legal and constitutional rights are protected. Again, if you dig into the actual language, you'll see that there are a lot of exceptions that allow, with reasonable suspicion, schools and administrative folks to still get access to deal with emergencies and other clear violations. The issue we're trying to address here is when you have a situation where it clearly could lead to a criminal consequence further down the road, and you don't have any reason to believe at that time that there would be any problem in getting a warrant in order to further investigate that. With that, I'll just wrap up by saying that, you know, this is a timely effort that would put Minnesota ahead of the curve when it comes to protecting student data privacy. I think we have a pretty good record in the state of trying to address these issues when they come up, and tend to be more privacy-friendly than some places. So I hope this gets positive consideration from the committee going forward, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Feist. Representative Yarusso, you have a question.
Yes, and in keeping with, you know, being in this committee, though, the education policy, not data practices, I'm kind of focusing on, you know, how does this fit in a school setting? And one of the things I shared with Representative Lucero earlier was that in a commercial setting, we had an example of Target data breaches previously. In a commercial setting, you have a clear distinction between the person whose data you're trying to protect and the product and the activities of the commercial entity. You know, because in Target's case, you're protecting the credit card information and the shopping history of a person, whereas we don't really care what Target does about its inventory of diapers and widgets. In a school setting, those two things are intertwined because the students are the product of the schools. They are the business of the school. And so it's not as easy to pull those two things apart. And so one of the things that's happened here, when you look on page 3, lines 3.13 to 3.16, in my opinion, the definition of a student information system is overly broad, because it's says a software application or cloud-based service. A software application is the part I'm going to focus on for the moment, that allows an educational institution to input, maintain, manage, or retrieve student data or personally identified student information, including applications that track and share personally identified student information in real time. Now, software application is really broad. That covers an extremely large amount of territory. And when people are writing this, you might imagine that the only things that would include the private student data would be the attendance tracking systems, the grade tracking systems, and those sorts of things. However, the individual teacher is always attaching personal student information to every single anything that has anything to do with that student, because you have to have their name on it. And so this broad software applications, and by the way, that the software applications are not purchased usually by the teacher, they're by the district, so it becomes a district thing being provided. Such things as Excel spreadsheets, word processing programs, PowerPoint, the PowerPoint and Word applications that the students use in the computer lab to write the reports that are submitted to the teacher. In the science field, you've got laboratory management software where you can take data directly, electronic data, and then turn that into your lab report. So the problem arises because since those things fit this broad definition, even though that's not the intent, they fit that, they then become subject to all of the rest of these constraints in the whole rest of the bill. Not the entire bill, but that entire section that entails the constraints and the safeguards and everything that are on those student information systems, because we have labeled them student information systems. So I think that we need to focus on, you know, which parts of it, and maybe there need, you know, to pull those two things apart, because I do have a legal obligation. Well, I already have a legal obligation under federal law as a teacher not to, you know, go spreading student information around and being careless with it. So I already actually have those obligations, so I don't need, you know, that to be changed. But I think you're going to put an undue burden on implementing this if you're now asking Microsoft, you know, to be responsible for this individual student data that the teacher is generating or the student themselves is generating because they wrote a lab report. And some of the retention things are not particularly appropriate then. Also, there's a, on page 8.6, any data transferred to the software application by the teacher is deleted by the teacher within 45 days of such time as it is no longer being actively used for classroom record keeping or management purposes. I'm not sure what being actively used for means for me, because my need to retain test score data and you know all of those grades associated things goes beyond the end of the semester. It doesn't have the same data retention requirements of some of the other records in school, but you do need to, for the sake of being able to go back and resolve any complaints or bias, and you know anything like that. It's unclear when that 45 days would kick in for me as a teacher. And there are some other pieces of this that say, you know, unless there's a current proceeding, you need to retain some information in the event that there will be such a proceeding before that's actually kicked in. So just from the teacher's perspective, those are the things I saw in this that I'd like to get tightened up.
Mr. Feist, would you, or Representative Urso, do you want to go first? Because we want to hear from Mr. Feist as well. Lucero. Good grief.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And
it's getting hot in here. I'm sorry, Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As I said this morning, I will completely agree with Representative Urso. We definitely need to make sure our definitions are clear. But let me take a different angle, potentially, at looking at the very legitimate concern that was just raised. So, defining, if we leave the definition, for example, as it is, and do continue to bring in that software and other things into scope, we still have to take into consideration that there are exceptions in the bill that allow for the use of that data by teachers, by school administration, etc. So focusing on the use of the data that's in those systems that gets wrapped up within that definition and the transferring of that data to third parties is where the controls and limitations are placed. We do not want to interfere with teachers, with school administrators, with schools, with everything they need to do to be able to educate children. So I'm just taking the very legitimate concern, like I said, and just taking a different angle at where we're placing the limitation once we do define software, etc.
And Mr. Feist, I have a question for you. Representative Urso referred on page 8 to lines
8.5 through 8.7, and I was a classroom teacher as well. And what kind of data are you, you know, we can't delete our the grades that we're accumulating. Not all of us have 45-day trimesters or whatever they might be. Some of us had semesters, and they last longer than 45 days. So we can't be deleting anything like that. So what was the thought when any data transferred to the software by the teacher is deleted within 45 days? Is it being actively used for classroom record keeping? Is that the key so my grades would remain because I'm actively using them? Or any comments I may have made about managing or helping a student? Mr. Feist.
Madam Chair, thank you for the question. I'm trying to dive in here. I think that is in this subdivision. It goes back to B on line 7.28. That's really talking about school employees not selling, sharing, otherwise transferring data.
Right.
Except, and then it provides these issues here. So, again, I'd be happy to take a closer look to figure out exactly how this all fits in. But as Representative Lucero pointed out here, we really don't want to be interfering with teachers' use. It's really supposed to be all about what kind of stuff's going on with the third parties. Are they data mining it? Are they selling it to other people and that sort of thing? So to the extent that there is an unforeseen issue there, I'm more than happy to work out those problems before anything would move forward in this bill.
And Representative Yarusso has a follow-up. So she's
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Could I just
Representative Lucero, go ahead.
Referencing the exact same thing, looking at line 7.28, school employees may not sell, share, or otherwise transfer. So this isn't speaking to teachers who need to retain for longer than 45 days. But if a teacher for some reason is going to sell, share, or transfer to a third party, that's when that 45-day retention is going to kick in to delete it afterwards. So it would be a different scenario than the one that was brought up.
Representative Yarusso.
Yarusso. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yarusso, thank you.
Might help if you pronounce it as Representative Marian would, as it would have been in Frangieto Labate. Yarusso.
Yarusso.
Thank you.
This is different.
Yes. So, you know, collectively, we're not questioning the intent. And the difficulty is that the intent isn't always what happens. And so we're looking at it from a lens of how would this happen in my school, not what is the intent. And so this you know, the intent is to not sell it to a third party. But in the process of working through what that looks like, there is this restriction about the 45 days. Okay. And then back to the page 3 issue, on the definition, it seemed like you were suggesting you would keep that broad definition, and I'm suggesting that this will be impossible to implement for some cases of software applications that would fit that definition. That you really cannot make Microsoft responsible for protecting student data as a teacher uses an Excel worksheet. But under statute, we would if this went through exactly the way it's worded. And so you either are going to have to tweak every one of these clauses that follow or fix that definition. And I think it would be easier to fix the definition. And really zero in on what the intent is, because you do have a vision of what kind of student data systems are we actually talking about. And some of the other things that you might say, well, but we might have a concern about this too, those are already covered under federal student data privacy. You know, my responsibility as the teacher is some of that's already covered. And so if we would, you know, focus it on the actual, you know, we're actually talking about these global school-wide student information systems. I think that would improve it. Thanks.
Representative Lucero?
Madam Chair, I do have a few other testifiers to testify in favor of the bill, if this would be the appropriate time.
Are there members with other questions for anything that has been referenced so far? Okay, welcome. Welcome to our committee, and say your name for the record and address the issues within the delete all. Thank you.
Good evening, Chair and committee. It's nice to see you again. My name is Linda Bell. I'm a parent and an educator for many, many years, and now somewhat of a researcher. My testimony tonight deals with technology on campus, the very section we were talking about in the bill. It will be page 12, 12.3, subdivision 3, use of location tracking technology. And my testimony speaks to internet service providers and software, the global campus internet providers. This is testimony from a student, a former student of mine that I know very, very well. He's a senior graduating from a university here in the Twin Cities, and he is getting his degree in the technology field. All right. Madam Chair and Education Committees, I am a college senior and attend a Twin Cities University. I would like to speak about the internet service at my college called Safe Connect. The system gives full administrative control over a student's personal computer to software developed by a company called Impulse Point. This software works with the internet service that my college offers when students are on campus. It is one of the many private internet services mandated by law that is supposed to protect students' data. Unfortunately, Safe Connect does not protect students or their data. Safe Connect does track a student on campus and does track them away from campus. The software claims to be a policy key, not an executable file. It tricks the user into installing it using common social engineering tactics. The software claims to check for antivirus and anti-spyware software, but does not check for either. If the software, Safe Connect, which is working with the students' student number through the college, they are able to see what the student is doing. They have access, and so they can gain privileges on the user's computer that goes beyond the webcam that Mr. Feist spoke about. Safe Connect can gain privileges to personal documents on the computer, access to webcams and microphones, ability to request a system shutdown and restart, ability to check whether antivirus firewall software is installed, as well as patch status and update information, ability to read network configuration information, ability to send and receive network traffic, ability to display prompts and respond to input on a user's computer, ability to install services and applications which run outside of the local user account, ability to modify network settings, ability to change firewall settings and permissions on operating system files, ability to modify other user accounts on the system and create new user accounts, ability to install kernel mode drivers and services which run under the system account, ability to install low-level keyboard hooks, which could be used to monitor all keystrokes and user enters into non-system programs running under any user account, ability to install and update any software on the system, ability to remove any file or application from the system. I'm skipping a lot of his list here. Ability to update the boot sector on NVR systems, to change firmware configuration metadata on EFI computers, and finally, the ability to install, remove, and update programs running with system-level privileges. And I had to ask him, what are system-level privileges? Well, that basically means it just takes over your computer. And so the questions of data sharing of Safe Connect with Impulse Point, of course, is of great concern. It speaks to the concerns of data sharing with third-party businesses. And I do certainly support this delete all bill with thoughtful amendments and encourage the committee and the chair to give this serious consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much. How did the student discover all this?
He's a smart cookie.
is good that we have these kinds of students because we can really be buffaloed by much of what is supposed to help us and protect us. Yep. Welcome, Ms. Taylor, back to the committee. Please say your name for the record and begin and address that which you may have.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Concerns about in this.
Yes, Ann Taylor here. I also have another testimony from someone that could not be here today. May I read that?
Certainly.
Okay, I will start with that. Thank you, and thank you, committee, for listening. This is from Shelley Pearson, a parent of four children in the Stillwater School District and is also a Stillwater Area Public Schools School Board member. Dear Madam Chair and committee members, as a parent in partnership with my children's educators, it is vitally important that I be informed as to what my children see, hear, and do at school. This includes any surveys they may be asked to take. As surveys sometimes come from for-profit companies that do not always have my children's best interest in mind. I would like the opportunity to discuss with my children any subjects that come up that they do not understand or have questions about. In addition, there may be surveys that I feel are developmentally inappropriate for their age and would choose to opt them out. I am also concerned by the potential amount of learning that could be lost as a result of increased surveys and would like the opportunity to make sure they are spending their time on meaningful tasks. As a school board member, it is our responsibility as partners with the district, parents, staff, and community to ensure parents have the most information as possible about children's education in order to provide the best possible education. It is part of our responsibility to provide strong communication with our stakeholders, including parents. Good communication breeds greater trust, which is something school districts need with parents who entrust their children to us every day. Thank you for your consideration of these opt-out and parental disclosure bills. I highly encourage Chair Erickson and the committee members to seriously consider these bills being heard today. Thank you, Shelley Peterson.
Thank you, Ms. Taylor. Did you have any comments to make about the deletal?
Yes.
Shirley, proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So by now, many of you understand or know I'm on the MAC board. We are nonpartisan. We have lots of teachers and parents on all political sides. The one thing we do share is protecting our kids and parent rights, especially now with data being so widely utilized in our schools. My interest when we first entered our school district started when we encountered our first data breach. When my child entered middle school, I started seeing surveys and with little information on them while using valuable classroom time while infringing on the private rights of my child, who was and who still is a minor in the eyes of the law. By the time my eldest child now has reached high school, the district encountered another breach. I have to wonder what of the breaches we don't know about through the use of third parties. 3 years ago, I heard a woman on the radio by the name of Linda Bell, also a teacher, who was discussing data collection in the schools. At that time, there's maybe a few hundred data points collected, and over the last few years, there's over 1,000 data points collected on children in the schools. It was soon after I communicated with Ms. Bell, I informed her on the growing number of online surveys my child has been exposed to, as well as the breach that first happened in 2011. And from there, it has taken almost 3 years to finally have some bills heard. I did speak before the school board, as I mentioned before, about my concerns with surveys and data collection. Clearly, it didn't do much good. By the time my child was a freshman at the high school, she was getting bombarded with surveys on a near weekly basis and during school time. And if it wasn't done during class, There is access from Schoology, the parent-student portal site, to do more surveys in their free time. I can tell you there are many parents, as I've mentioned before, concerned about the behavioral Class Dojo app in the elementary schools, and consequently, many are starting to pull their kids in homeschool instead. How will this affect our communities? I have opted my child out as much as possible from taking nefarious surveys, some of which may actually violate PPR. I'm not sure what asking personal information of students from familial status to social media sites used is considered to be part of one-to-one learning, especially when I, the parent, am not being notified. Should my child access a survey, any third party that's being utilized in the schools, without my knowledge or permission, even understanding, will I be notified if that third party happens to have a breach? Still, myself and parents around the state continue to ask, who is collecting this information, and where are third parties sharing and storing it, and why? My greatest concern is open PII, data that's sitting for months, possibly years at a time, on my child in various unknown places. I have a teenager, and I also have a four-year-old. And after hearing this afternoon's testimony, I am a little concerned at how ELSA is also being shared and stored at the Minnesota Department of Education that was revealed today. The same institution that has not had an audit on over 40 contractors in 10 plus years. So please, for the sake of our children, together let us pass these bills. We understand that there's language that needs to be cleaned up and clarifications that need to be made, but let's do this so that we can empower our parents and while protecting our rights. Thank you.
So, Ms. Taylor, were these surveys used as tools during the lesson or in regard to units or lessons that were being taught?
Madam Chair, some yes and some no.
Representative Bennett has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank Representative Lucero for your great presentation this morning and continuing, and for the testifiers, too. This is a really important subject, and it is really due some thoughtful work, you know, both now and in the future. Just a quick question, because I want to make sure that teachers will still have the flexibility to use technology in their classrooms and not be bound unduly, but with the same time keeping good data privacy things here. But question being, if a teacher is using an informal survey, you know, there's a lot of great tech tools now and apps that you can actually use with cell phones and put an immediate graph right on the smart board or so on, or the clicker devices that they have. If it's an immediate survey that's not going to be stored anywhere, really, just utilized for instruction in the classroom, is that part of this? Will that inhibit a teacher from utilizing that kind of instruction? Because that is powerful instruction.
Representative Lucero.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bennett. And as a technologist, both a technologist myself and an educator myself, having taught college level for 7 years, I cannot emphasize enough how beneficial technology in the classroom is. And as a conservative, my goal is to squeeze the highest level of efficiency possible, right, to lower costs. Mm-hmm. And technology allows us to do that. So for the benefit of the schools, I am full in favor of using technology to increase efficiencies and decrease costs. And then for the sake of education and for the sake of our children, utilizing technology to get them hands-on experience to be the most competitive that they can in a global workforce. And that is what's going to empower our children, again, with experience and knowledge, so that they can compete. And so, no, this will not, once we get this standardized language cleaned up and fit in its proper spot here in Minnesota, no, it will not inhibit teachers from educating our children, because our teachers are working very hard and are very dedicated to the future of our children. And this will only help them. It'll help bring clarity and stability to an area right now that is not well-defined. And it'll help them, again, to maximize what they love doing best.
I have a question for School Boards Association, perhaps, if you would come. And perhaps I need a teacher prep program, more importantly, but my question deals with the renewal credits that teachers earn to renew licensure, and the fact that included in there, and now included in teacher preparation, is technology, their learning about technology as a tool in the classroom. And I'm wondering if you know to what extent they're also taught about protecting the data from which they may receive from students. Welcome to our committee. Please say your name for the
record. Good evening, Madam Chair. Peter Martin, the Minnesota School Board Association. I am personally not familiar with the curriculum for that, but I'm sure we can get that information for the committee.
That would be very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there other testifiers? Please.
Good evening. I'm sure you're all hungry and ready for dinner, so I'll try to make this quick. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today in opposition of House File 2898 as amended. My name is Sarah Kluck, and I'm the Executive Director of Know What's Inside, the largest coalition of educational application developers in the world. We have over 500 member companies, most of them small businesses, committed to following clear and consistent rules protecting student privacy and limiting information sharing without proper consent. Know What's Inside provides parents and teachers with information in plain English to help them decide which app is right for their kids. I urge this committee to adopt legislation similar to language passed in states like Maryland and Georgia. This legislation makes great strides to protect student privacy by banning the sale of student data, requiring providers to maintain adequate security procedures, and much more. By adopting the language, this body would recognize both the need to protect student privacy and the importance of robust innovation in the educational technology space. I, like most here, am a product of the Minnesota educational system. I attended Withrow Elementary School in District 834 in the late 80s and early 90s. I actually have a photo from that time holding the school's first modem in our computer classroom. I think our entire class of 27 students took a picture with that modem. We were lucky to be in that school, not just because of the modem, but because of the groundbreaking Minnesota Educational Computing Consortium that emerged shortly before that time. MEC really changed the way of technology in the schools, not just for Minnesota, but for students across the country and around the world. MEC drove the adoption of educational technology into school curriculum. Math, coding, geography, and reading were covered in computer class, not just typing. I'll bet that at least a few of you in this room today learned a little bit about geography by fording rivers while playing Oregon Trail in computer lab. If you're a bit rusty on geography, I'm happy to recommend some great apps made by small businesses today. The technology used in classrooms today is much different from the technology of the 80s. Kids are no longer storing their game progress on 3.5-inch diskettes stored in a locked case in the computer lab. Unit progress is often stored on the cloud. If a teacher notices a particular student is having trouble with a lesson, they can recommend a website or an app the student can use at home or in the library to supplement classroom learning.
There are infinite possibilities of where learning can go thanks to technology. Technology isn't bound by state borders. This is huge business, but this isn't big business. In fact, many educational technology companies are small businesses that were started by educators, parents, and therapists looking to make a difference in kids' lives. Students from the Red River Valley to the Minnesota River Valley can visit some of the world's most important historical sites without leaving their community. Educational app developers don't need to leave Minnesota for Silicon Valley to build a successful tech company. The app economy thrives in Minnesota and anywhere that people choose to develop their apps. The opportunity is that economic growth can occur in any location because it is relatively independent of widely recognized centers of innovation. The key to this isn't lax regulation, it's consistent regulation. I worry that some of the innovation and progress that has been made in the educational technology arena, kicked off by the work done in this state, might suffer if House File 2898 is adopted as written. Small business innovators are not developing technology for particular states. They're developing technology for students to learn and to grow. My members want to protect student privacy and to be transparent about their practices. I fear they may cease to create innovative products if a variety of state laws become too onerous to follow. I urge this committee to adopt legislation similar to that passed in Maryland and Georgia. I have copies, and I think some were made available to the committee earlier today. And I'm happy to take questions. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to represent Withrow Elementary School proudly.
And thank you for providing us with copies of Maryland and Georgia. Are there questions from members?
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Others? Yes. Please say your name for the record and begin. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Matt Ealing. I'm here on my own behalf today. My background is varied, but it involves issues of civil liberties, government data, personal privacy. I've covered these issues as a member of the press in the past. I've been an advocate around these issues. I currently serve on two boards involved with issues regarding government data. I'm going to speak specifically to HF 2898 and the component that preceded the delete all, the one-to-one computing bill.
Please.
I have a particular personal angle on this because my son attends a district where one of these one-to-one computing programs is utilized, and I've watched it roll out, so I'm familiar with some of the features that they have. So I'm speaking in support of Representative Lucero's bill due to the fact that these one-to-one computing programs in schools pose data sharing and privacy issues that are unique, and I think they require state-level attention because we really haven't seen localities deal with them in a serious way as of yet. As we've seen these programs rolled out across the country, we've seen problems arise involving both government actors and private sector actors. And what I want to outline today are some of the key reasons why I think this bill deserves your support today from a high-level perspective. The first thing I'd have you take away is that limitations really need to be placed on how the data that's captured by these devices is used. So iPads, other school-issued one-to-one devices, they can capture a great deal of personal information if people have already talked about today. The districts will tell you this is in service of educational goals, and enhanced educational programming, after all, is the rationale for using these devices in schools. Since that's the case, I think it's self-evident that the data that these devices gather should be used for those educational purposes and not be used for ancillary and unrelated purposes. The problem is that this has not always been the case in practice. We've seen across the country vendors who provide these one-to-one systems to schools. They've used student data for their own business purposes, really unrelated to educational purposes. And I'd like to draw your attention to the materials I believe were provided this morning. There's written testimony. On the back, there's the Apple ID, Create Your Student's Apple ID Consent Agreement. And what this is, how this is used, is that this is the consent agreement that students or parents have to execute with Apple computer prior to the use of an Apple iPad in many school districts. And as you can see, it's detailed. It has several provisions. It's important to know that the first step really to creating the Apple ID is entering a student's real name and actual date of birth. That's specified here in the language. The reason why it's important to understand this is that once you have an individual's identity attached to the device, then any subsequent data that's created or captured on the device is correlated to that individual. And so you're really talking about identifying a big data set based on the input of these very simple pieces of data. Next, you'll see that the agreement states that Apple can then gather personal data on these individual students, including the following types of information. Information about the websites they visited, their interactions with Apple products, Apple software, certain location data about where the device was used, and so forth. And most importantly, you'll see that this agreement explicitly states that this kind of information can be shared for marketing and for advertising purposes. And it explicitly states that it can be shared with companies that Apple identifies as its strategic partners. And so the breadth of that language is permissive, both in the kinds of data it allows to be collected and in the uses to which it can be put. Now, schools should really be aware of the agreements that they're entering into and the impact of these agreements on individual students. Also, as bulk purchasers of computing devices, and some of the contracts run into the tens of millions of dollars for procuring these iPads or other one-to-one devices, they really should have the negotiating power to say, we're going to use the data the way we want to. Your purposes for marketing are not applicable. And again, the problem is that they haven't used their bargaining power to do that. And so that's really why it's important to set out in state law that they cannot use student data for marketing purposes. They should be used for educational purposes. Secondly, students and parents should not be put in a position where they're compelled to enter into data sharing agreements with private companies. So these decisions about whether to participate in one-to-one computing programs that gather this kind of personal information, that should be left up to students and to parents. These should be voluntary participatory efforts, not compelled efforts. And this is especially true with one-to-one programs that involve signing agreements, like the iPad consent agreement, with a private company. So having schools compel students to execute these contracts, or having them compel parents to execute these contracts, is problematic for several reasons. First, you take the voluntariness out of this transaction. And the voluntariness is really necessary to having a valid contract in the first place. Secondly, I think it's not an appropriate place for the government to insert itself into the contractual agreement by saying, you two private parties need to form a contract with each other. That's just not an appropriate role of government. And so the bill really recognizes these problems, and it sets out both an opt-in framework for one-to-one computer use in schools, and it also bars making use of these devices conditioned upon signing any kind of agreement with a private vendor. So I think that's important to note. Thirdly, one-to-one computing devices should not be turned into all-purpose student surveillance devices. And people have spoken to some of this before today, but I do want to turn your attention to a particular example. In 2010, lawsuits were filed against the Lower Merton School District in Pennsylvania after it was revealed that employees of two high schools had covertly triggered webcams in district-issued laptops, and they captured over 60,000 photographs of high school students in their bedrooms and other private places, and they got sued for it. I mean, you don't have to. I think it's self-obvious the privacy problems this creates. But it does provide a real concrete example of why the provisions of this bill that would place limitations on how these webcams and the surveillance components of these devices could be used. Finally, in closing, there's a broader cultural aspect to the use of one-to-one computing that should be recognized. And it's this. Schools are really, in many cases, the first large institution that a child interfaces with. And in many cases, they're the first government institution. And the nature of the interactions they have really teach them lessons, unspoken civics lessons about the nature of their society, about the nature of the interactions between government and individuals. So should one of those early formative lessons that they get be that government has the unlimited right to eavesdrop on you through your school-issued computer? should one of those early lessons be that the government can compel you to enter an agreement with a private company? What sort of citizens and what sort of society do those lessons create? So I'd ask you to think about that and support this bill that Representative Lucero has brought forward. I'd be happy to take any questions.
Members, are there questions? He has an excellent written testimony that you could re-examine if you like.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Are there others? Mr. Aronson? Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Roger Aronson, I represent the Elementary and Secondary Principal Association. And I know that you're going to lay this over and visit about it some more. We're deeply concerned about the ACLU template, as you heard it here earlier tonight, some of the provisions in it that relate to the fundamentally the search and seizure components of student devices. I mean, if you read that closely, if we had some reason to be looking at a student's cell phone, whether it was that he was involved in a suspected drug transaction, a bullying incident, whatever it might be, the steps that we would have to go through here to handle that are far beyond anything that we do anywhere else. I mean, it basically says that we have to write a reason down before we would do the search, that we'd have to attempt to contact the parent, secure the parent's consent, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, and really, we don't look at the phone any differently than we look at a backpack, a locker, a car, a student's jacket, you know, whatever it might be. It is important to keep in mind in this, and we'll go through this, but we have 860,000 students that come to school. We actually have a duty to protect all of them. When the kids come, the constitutional rights on these search and seizure pieces are different than when they're out on the street, et cetera. Their speech rights are different than when they're out on their own time. And it's necessary overall to make schools work. Very easy to sit back and draft a policy to say, let's hit all of these things, you know, and you'll have a two-day window to do the search. This school stuff and school discipline happens very quickly. You know, and this may very, say the fundamental discipline in schools is a teacher looking at somebody and say, stop that. I mean, that's the first part of this. And so as we go through this, I mean, I think we need to have a real concern to how do we make schools work and to protect the data rights of everyone that's involved. And we can do that. But some of these are a bit onerous, and we'll be looking at very closely at those. Okay? Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'd answer any questions you may
have. Mr. Aronson, have you looked at Maryland or Georgia's proposals?
I haven't, Madam Chair.
I think
I will now.
You could receive them from Mr. Feist. No. Who had them? Ms. Kleck. Yes. She could share them with you or make them available.
Yeah. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Aronson. Are there others?
Please. Madam Chair, while
yes.
that this first coming up, I'm just going to address a few of those.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to address a few of those remarks. And I understand it is still template language that is going to be revised. But we've heard numerous times, both this morning and this evening now, in the context of law enforcement, when you read the language, there are multiple provisions recognizing exigent circumstance and the need for accessing devices in a timely manner. And so under non-exigent circumstances, yes, permission is required before you access the device, whether it be from the child in certain circumstances or an adult. But in exigent circumstances, permission is granted right away to access it, and then within 48 hours to write down the reason for accessing it. And that's not an undue burden. Within 48 hours to write down the reason, the justification for accessing a private property, accessing private property, and then notifying, again, within 48 hours of the parent. An analogy was made between phones and was just admitted that they do not view phones any different than a backpack or a jacket. That is not an appropriate analogy. A better analogy would be a jacket doesn't contain very personal contacts, email addresses, web browsing history, etc. A more appropriate analogy would be perhaps a diary. You wouldn't simply go through and thumb through somebody's diary because it contains very personal information without a justification for doing so. So that would be the better analogy. But with that, Madam Chair, I'll turn it over to the next testifier.
Welcome back to the testifying table. Please say your name again and proceed.
Good evening, Madam Chair. Peter Martin, Minnesota School Boards Association. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that there's a lot of things that you could say about this bill. I just wanted to highlight a couple of things. And I start with the premise that one of the members of the committee referenced earlier is when I look at a bill, I look at how is it going to be, assuming this is what's going to be law, how will our constituents operationalize it on a day-to-day basis? And I think that there are some real significant issues here. On the issue of student searching, as a threshold matter, I want people to remember that in 1985, the United States Supreme Court issued the decision of New Jersey versus TLO, which basically set the constitutional standard for searches in the school setting. The Supreme Court specifically said that no search warrants were required by school officials to search students in the school setting because of the unique relationship between schools and students, and that only a reasonable suspicion was required. That is the law of the land to this day. Obviously, this would turn the constitutional concept on its head quite substantially. So with that in mind, since then, school districts, when it comes to school-provided property, schools have viewed, and I think this is very well established, that anything that we provide to students that we own, we get access to. There is no expectation of privacy in that. And I cite as a reference section 121A72, which deals with school lockers. And it says, in part, school lockers are the property of the school district. At no time does the school district relinquish its exclusive control for the convenience of students. Inspection of interiors of lockers may be conducted by school authorities for any reason and any time without notice. That is the law of Minnesota. And from the school standpoint, if we are providing an electronic device to someone, an iPad or a laptop computer, we own the device. It is ours. And there is no expectation of privacy in those devices that we provide. And there are internet use agreements and things that schools use to make that quite clear to everyone at the outset. As there were some comments made earlier regarding internet use agreements by Apple and others, the committee needs to know too, there is a federal law called the Child Online Privacy Protection Act, which requires a verified written consent of parents, and that verified consent form under the federal statute requires the web-based provider to explain in detail how that data is going to be used, and parental consent is required. If parental consent is not obtained, you don't your information is not submitted to that provider. So there are restrictions in place. The Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, which applies to all public schools that are recipients of federal financial assistance, contains limitations on redisclosure of personally identifiable information to third parties. Those protections have been in existence for a long time. So it's not like that we're operating in a vacuum here. There is a fair amount of protection. But getting back to the issue of searches and so on, we have to have access to those devices if we need to. If there's this committee was involved substantially in the passage of the Safe and Supportive Minnesota Schools Act. There is an affirmative obligation to commence an investigation of a act of prohibited conduct, which would include cyberbullying, within a certain time. These procedures could impede progress of that, and I'm just citing that as one example of where the proliferation of electronic devices could impede an investigation of something quite serious in the school setting. So we're really concerned about that. There are some administrative burdens as well here, too. One is the general concept, and I think it was referred to earlier, the general concept of opt-in versus opt-out. The opt-out concept really comes from federal law, and to require everybody to opt in rather than opt out would be enormously burdensome and expensive for school districts. And then the issue of data retention, the statutes, the proposals require data deletion within 90 days or 180 days. The committee should be aware that all government bodies, including school districts, are required to have records retention policies. And typically, records, education records, are required to be kept for an established period of time that I can assure you is longer than 90 days or 180 days. Moreover, any data related to federally funded programs, the Minnesota Department of Education has issued guidance in the recent past that says you have to retain that information for 5 years. And then the last thing I just wanted to say is when we're talking about computer devices, too, some of these devices are actually used by special ed students, assistive technology devices. Yeah. For example, someone with a communication disability that may need a device, and that data is tracked over and over again by people on an IEP team and so on. I am concerned about the reach of that as well. So these are some general thoughts that I had. I just wanted to call these matters to the attention of the committee. There's a lot more that could be said, but that's all I have to say right now.
Very good. Thank you very much. Are there questions for the testifier? Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've heard several times today, and we have, that it's going to be very expensive for school districts to manage an opt-in rather than an opt-out. I don't understand how that would work. Can you flesh that out a little bit, please?
Mr. Martin.
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. What we're surmising is that a school district isn't going to be able to implement a program, you know, if staff are waiting to get people to respond to an opt-in type of scenario, trying to track down and maintain paperwork on an opt-in is basically a school district with thousands of students. You're going to have to allocate staff time for that purpose. It's an administrative burden, and you have to keep track of those things. So that's I'm not being terribly specific at this point, but it's going to be administratively burdensome to keep track of that and to manage it.
Representative Ward, are you thinking? Because if you are, I have a question.
Go ahead.
Mr. Martin, isn't it an opt-in for a parent to sign off on free or reduced lunch? I used to have those forms available in my classroom. I didn't hand them out, obviously, because there's a privacy issue. But I made them available in a location where students could pick them up. Their parents had to fill that out, sign off, if they were going to qualify. Isn't that an opt-in?
I'm not intimately familiar with those free and reduced lunch regulations, Madam Chair. So I can't speak to that issue. But obviously, when we're talking about personally identifiable information, we're talking about the entire universe of students in a school district. So it's a much broader base.
Well, in some school districts, Mr. Martin, there's quite a number of families who have to fill out some very personal information and submit it to the school district, which then maybe Mr. McHenry could clarify this, but then I believe the school district submits, I don't think they submit those forms, but I've been told that there's not even a checking to see if there's actually a sure qualification for that. But anyway, I consider it an opt-in.
Yeah, I wish I could provide more information to the committee. I'm just not familiar with it.
Representative Ward.
Thank you. I'm still vague on this. It seems to me that currently everyone is opting in to this, and you have to specifically opt out. So all of these students are in the program unless the family specifically doesn't opt out, which means there's paperwork and there's administrative pieces to do for those people. So it seems to me that it would just be flipped so that everyone was automatically out, and it would only be if someone wanted to opt in that they would do that. So somehow I'm missing something.
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll just use the example of directory information under FERPA and indeed our state Minnesota Government Data Practices Act. You're supposed to provide a FERPA notice every year that describes your definition of directory information and what you will disclose pursuant to that definition, and you also must notify the parent of their ability to opt out. If the inverse were true, that means that the district would have to get an opt-in form for every single family for every single school year. And if you don't, that means that there's no student directory, there's no pictures in the yearbook, there's all kinds of complications that arise from that.
I think Representative Lucero wanted to say something, and then maybe I'll have another question. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as was mentioned this morning, I want to make sure that we don't blend two different issues. One issue is directory information. That's not what's in scope here. And so what was just referenced, that there would be no yearbooks, no et cetera, that's not true. What we're talking about is PII. We're talking about sharing PII with third parties. So there is another option. What was just mentioned, that there'd be an undue burden to touch every student and get an opt-in form. Here's another option. Don't share PII with third parties. Then the school would have zero burden to have to get opt-in forms.
Representative Ward, further questions?
I think that takes care of it.
Representative Yarusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm glad you made that point just now, because that actually ties into what I want to, the point I want to make. Schools don't write their own software and don't maintain their own servers, typically. And so it's somewhat impossible to avoid the use of third parties in some way. And a good example of this is the lunch system. It is true that parents opt in to apply for, if they want to apply for free or reduced lunch benefits, because they have to provide some personal income information and things like that. However, every student in the school has personal information in the system, because every single student in the school has a lunch account. And if we require that you have to opt in before you can have those sorts of records being handled by a third party, how will you even tell the people that need to opt in that they need to opt in? Because I'm seeing a logical inconsistency in that if we can't hold student data, we can't contact students to get the opt-in that you would require. And so it's again getting to the question of, don't overstep. Don't make it too broad, because you're going to kill it if you do, because it's going to turn into something that will not work. So, you know, don't take the suggestions about get this monster under control as criticism of the whole project, because I think it's actually something that you have to address to make this work. And there's great intent in a lot of this, but if you let it get away from you and let the most extreme viewpoints drive the broadness of the definitions and everything that you're going to grab in and pull into this thing, it's going to kill it, because it will not work. So, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Representative Lucero.
Point well taken.
Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Martin.
Yes, ma'am.
I remember, you know, as a first grade teacher, having to collect certain types of information from every student, permission to publish, you know, to be in the newspaper, that kind of thing, or an internet agreement every year, and we had to make sure that every student had that. Would this be somewhat similar to that, in what Representative Lucero is asking?
Mr. Martin.
Madam Chair, Representative, in regard to, I see your question as being related specifically to the opt-in concept, and I think that those concepts are, from what you're describing and what I experienced, my mother was a school teacher for 31 years, I think those are different things. The opt-in requirements that are set forth in this bill are much more detailed and prescriptive than the matters that you're talking about. And and much more broad in scope, I think.
Are there other questions from members? We're nearing the hour that, I'm Representative Flanagan, please.
Thank you, Madam.
We're nearing the hour, you know, that I want to close off this, but no, we want to hear from you, please. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just had a quick question regarding in line 1311 under training required. Just wondering who develops the training, who provides the training. This could get a little sticky, so I'm just wondering if you have sort of a sense of what that looks like. And this is actually for Representative Lucero.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just reading it, so just give me one moment here. Okay, Madam Chair, so this is not specific to who would be providing the training, but what I can do is give how I would read this and how I would interpret it. So in the private sector of which I operate, in my job, we are all familiar with, there are typically two types of trainings that most of us as employees of an employer go through. Number one would be sexual harassment training. Most of us who are familiar with this process get an employee handbook of some kind. And on day number one, or in the first week, or sometimes it's the first 30 days, new employees must go through a series of training to review company policies such as sexual harassment, et cetera, acceptable use policies for technology. And then I've been in organizations where on an annual basis, that same concept, there was training that was done regarding technology, the use of technology, the limitations thereof, what employees or what was acceptable, not acceptable. And all of that training was developed in-house, or they brought in a trainer from the outside, and then the employees would have to cycle through. There would be, you know, if it were over 30 days, it was all online. It was an online training in-house that the employees would review the videos, sexual harassment training, and then would give their digital signature that they participated and agreed to abide by. So that's just one example of how I would interpret this, that the schools themselves would determine in-house who's going to provide the training. And it's not insurmountable, because it happens all the time, to go through a particular training to train, in this case, employees of the school district that may supervise, direct, or participate in a one-to-one program or access any one-to-one data, the proper use.
Mr. Martin, did you want to comment on that?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representatives, members of the committee, one of my concerns about the training component is we're not allowed to engage in a one-to-one program until we have the training. There are ongoing programs. Technology is pervasive in public schools. There are programs already in place. So, you know, we need to look at, I would presume that whatever, if anything is arrived at, that we would need to give serious consideration to a delayed effective date, and the effective date has been variable in some of the bills that we have seen. I think one said January 1 of 2017, but there have been others that said the date after enactment. If that's the case, then we've got some real issues. So the training piece is we have to find out who's going to provide the training, who's going to pay for it. Those are issues as well, but also making it operational is another question, because we already have programs in place.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just real quick, and that's a very valid point. Delaying such as that for existing employees, maybe delaying it for a year. Right, but then for new employees, as I just mentioned, sexual harassment training, it doesn't mean that a new employee, a new hire, isn't able to function until they've gone through sexual harassment training, in my example. It just means they can start performing their job duties immediately, but they have to complete the training within 30 days. So it'd be something like that for this context. And then there are many other trainings I know that teachers have to go through. I think we heard a bill about adding a one-hour course on suicide prevention.
Yes.
There's many other trainings. So this would just be another training that would be added to the trainings that currently exist for teachers.
Do you have that open to that page? Pass it to me. Representative Seltzer, did you have a question?
Just really quickly, I just had a comment, Chair Erickson, and that is that, and I want to thank Representative Lucero for bringing this forward. I think we do need to take a look at making sure that we're guarding our students' safety and privacy. I know our schools, you know, I'm sure do their best, but this is a new area, and things like the Apple agreement, you know, is concerning. I think that our chair has shown great wisdom in saying this is something we really need to examine carefully, because as Representative Russo said, it could turn into something very unmanageable. And I think it's a great idea to bring all the stakeholders to the table. And as a former teacher and a former school board chair, I know that administering programs, you know, often are much more meaty than it may appear in writing. And just one final comment that, you know, if as we look at this and as we all come to a common agreement around how to best protect, and we do need to protect our children's safety and privacy, that if indeed there are any additional duties, administrative burdens, more time or staff needed for our school districts, that we need to then look at providing them with the resources so that within which they can reasonably do that, so that we're not taking money away from the area that, you know, that is the primary responsibility of our schools, and that is the education of the children. So thank you.
Representative Ward, you have the last question.
Thank you. More of a comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. I totally support the intention and the conversation that we've just been having, and recognize that the teachers will need training on this. And that flags for me just a concern that we are providing enough time and reimbursing teachers for that time. And wondering if we shouldn't be looking at all of the requirements. And when we do this with licensing of all kinds, what are we asking for? Just, I'd like, you know, a list of all of the things that are required for teachers to do. And maybe we need to evaluate the training that we're requiring of teachers and consider what we're asking schools to do. Because, you know, we keep talking about adding tests and adding things for teachers to do in the classroom. I'm just also wanting to be cognizant of what we're asking them to be trained in.
Good point. And part of that is for renewal credits. And it'll probably come up in our task force or study group that we have this summer when we deal with licensure. Closing comments, Representative Passero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I will do is I'll just be very brief to address a few other remarks we heard, and then very brief with my closing comment. We heard that a reference to 1985 and precedent by the Supreme Court. That is very, that relates to exactly what I discussed this morning. That 1985 happens to be the very same decade that Chapter 125B was written, and that very clearly demonstrates the need to update this. And then there was a remarks about, again, it would handcuff schools from being able to administer law enforcement activities in response to exigent circumstances, for example. But throughout the bill, it specifically uses the language reasonable, articulable suspicion. So I'm going to just draw on my law enforcement background. So there is a continuum. It's called the use of force continuum. The use of force continuum, on one end, the use of force continuum, as you work up, you can remove more and more liberty from a citizen. It starts with a hunch. Nothing can be done on a hunch. And this is not exhaustive, but this is some notches on the continuum. The next would be reasonable suspicion. Reasonable suspicion allows law enforcement officers to, for example, stop somebody. But they can't take them into custody. They can stop them. The next level up is probable cause. The threshold for probable cause requires particular items to be seized in a particular place, a particular place and items to be seized when searching. And then that threshold, law enforcement officer can take more liberties away, such as taking somebody into custody. The next level up would be propensity of the evidence. That means more likely than not, 50% plus one, in order to convict somebody in a civil case, for example. Then near the top of the continuum is beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's where you can remove somebody's liberties completely. And I'm just using that as an example because what was the examples that were cited as if the schools and administration law enforcement would not be able to engage in activities such as looking at devices, etc. That's not true. Because reasonable suspicion, the language in the bill, is on the low end of the continuum. It was mentioned lockers are the property of the school. Absolutely. But our personal mobile devices are not the property of the school. I will never argue that the school, I would always defend the school has the right to search their own property, such as their own electronic devices that have been issued. I won't argue that position. Mm-hmm. But the position that's being referenced in this bill is
personal
items. And our personal property, the school cannot come in and search your vehicle because it's sitting in the parking lot. That's personal property. Again, we have to make sure we have our analogies straight here. I'll leave it with that, and I'll end with these closing comments, Madam Chair. As was shown here, we had a lot of great conversation. This is a very important item. And there are a lot of smart people in this room. Madam Chair, you're probably the smartest in the room.
Oh,
I would
dear.
Say followed by Representative Mariani. But
I
think you better name everybody representative.
But what we all have in common is this group, the stakeholders out there. I've met with the department this afternoon. I've met with other stakeholders, and everybody is motivated. I haven't heard anybody dissent from the concept of what we're getting here. The dissent is, and I completely agree, there are details that definitely need to be worked out. So I'm very much looking forward to working with these motivated stakeholders so that we can protect. And a comment was mentioned, keeping Minnesota ahead of the curve. We pride ourselves here in Minnesota in multiple areas of being ahead of the curve, being innovative. And that's what we want to do in this particular topic, is to be ahead of the curve and to demonstrate, have other parts of the country look to us as we move forward with this on the cutting edge. So, Madam Chair, with that, I look forward to the continued effort in this topic.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. This has been most interesting. And thank you again to all those who came to testify to share their concerns or their support. Between biennia, we are going to probably have a study group dealing with this topic, like we may have a task force or a study group studying a few other things. So, members, I will be laying this over, and then we will have some discussions. Please talk to Representative Lucero about what you think would be the best way to proceed between this biennium and the next. Hopefully, we'll all be back here to discuss this. Members, we won't meet again now till next Tuesday, so have a great weekend. This meeting is adjourned.